Okay. Good morning and welcome. I'd like to start by thanking the City of Fresno for making this wonderful facility available. I haven't been here before, and it's very nice. For those of you on the webcast, you should be here in person. And welcome also to those on the webcast. I'm Chuck Schulock, Assistant Executive Officer at the Air Resources Board and Head of the Office of Climate Change. With me at the table here and making today's presentation will be Kevin Kennedy, John Costantino, and Edie Chang. We have a number of other ARB staff available to answer questions, and that's really what today is about, is to get comments, have some discussion about the draft scoping plan that was released a couple of weeks ago. It's an honor for me to be here to welcome the public to our second workshop on the climate change draft scoping plan. It's certainly one of the most important and far-reaching initiatives that the ARB has undertaken. It places California at the forefront of the effort by states to mitigate the impacts of global warming. We have little precedent to go on as we move forward. We're trailblazers here, and the rest of the nation and the world is watching California as we develop an approach to reducing greenhouse gases. This approach has many goals: to protect California's environment, to provide us with cleaner air, and to also balance the needs of our economy, driving innovation and helping to develop new technologies. I'd like to recognize the work of others in the development of this draft plan, the Climate Action Team, which is a group of other state agencies, and they established subgroups which looked carefully at many of these issues. We have a Market Advisory Committee, an Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, and an Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee, all of whom provided input along the way, and we're still looking forward to their further comments. This draft scoping plan is also the product of many workshops, work groups, and technical sessions that provided staff with insight, guidance, and thoughtful observations and comments by stakeholders and the general public. This workshop continues that conversation and discussion regarding the implementation of AB 32 that started with the early actions, our setting of the emission inventory. We've set mandatory reporting requirements. There's been a lot of work underway already, and this is certainly building upon that. So this workshop today continues that public involvement, but also begins a new chapter as we move forward towards establishing our recommendations for what needs to happen to get the state to 1990 emission levels by 2020. Public input will continue to be a crucial element as we move forward over the next 3 years to develop effective regulations, policies, and measures. And in 5 years, we're required to revisit the plan to see if it's accomplishing the goals and requirements of AB 32. AB 32 is by definition, or is the definition, of a landmark law. But unlike our other efforts, AB 32 encompasses the widest possible range of sources of emissions, from vehicles and fuels to ships, power generation. It deals with industrial output, refrigerants, agriculture, and forests. Its recommendations encompass renewables, landfills, high-speed rail, land use planning. So there's just a broad range of topics that are covered in this plan. All of these measures will engage collectively every sector of the state's economy and will touch the lives of Californians for years to come. So on behalf of the Air Resources Board, I call upon those of you in the room, those of you on the webcast, and members of the public throughout the state to fully engage in this process. The way we have the agenda set up, we're going to go through a staff presentation that outlines the draft recommendations that we have and the draft scoping plan that we've put forth. So we'll start by speaking for a while to get through that staff presentation, and then we're just going to open it up to public comment, not in any structured way. We thought about this back and forth, stopping for each section or something like that, but what we thought would be most effective and work best for the public would be to just open it up for broad-based public comments. We're handing out numbers for those of you that wish to speak, and we're going to enforce, I think, a four-minute time limit per speaker, so please contain your remarks to that amount of time. If you have written comments, we are happy to accept them. But in the interest of the group and the collective and the rest of the members of the group, we'd ask that you keep your remarks within that time limit. For those of you that are on the web, we also will accept questions over the web, and the address to use is ccworkshops@arb.ca.gov, and I'm told that that will be up as a banner on the screen throughout the course of the workshop. So if you decide later you have a question, that address should be there before you. And I think that's it as far as logistics go. So why don't we go ahead and begin the staff presentation with Kevin Kennedy. Thank you.
As Chuck said, I'm Kevin Kennedy with the Office of Climate Change at the Air Resources Board, and I want to add my welcome to Chuck's, to everyone both here and those listening on the website, to this, the second of our three major workshops on the draft scoping plan. These three big workshops are just sort of the tip of the iceberg on the public comment and outreach opportunities over the next couple months. We definitely are looking for a lot of input from all of you as we move forward towards completing the scoping plan later this year. As Governor Schwarzenegger has said, the time for action is now on climate change. Climate change is perhaps the most serious environmental issue facing the world today, and current climate science is suggesting that climate change is actually coming faster than had been previously predicted, so the need for action now is even more urgent than had previously been believed. With the passage of AB 32, the governor and the legislature have set bold goals for California. The draft scoping plan, we believe that we are providing a comprehensive recommendation that addresses all of the significant sources of greenhouse gas emissions in California. In terms of today's presentation, as Chuck mentioned, we're going to sort of run through the entire staff presentation, providing an overview of the draft scoping plan, including walking through the preliminary recommendations. We'll be talking about the additional measures that are still under consideration beyond those that are recommended at this stage, and give you an update on the various evaluations that are part of the scoping plan process overall. We have decided to structure it this way in order to try to maximize the amount of time that's available for us to hear from you guys. So we definitely are looking forward to hearing your comments as we move forward. So the draft scoping plan itself, the primary purpose is to lay out the roadmap for how California will get its greenhouse gas emissions back to 1990 levels by 2020. The measures in the plan will also, because they are looking to reduce combustion of fossil fuels and generally reduce a lot of the greenhouse gas activities, we believe that they will promote the development of the clean energy sector, will help protect and improve the public health in the state. And we see a lot of opportunities for improved economic growth in the state through the implementation of this plan. We also believe, and this is very important, that by California taking action through the scoping plan and the measures that we've identified, that we can help spur action at the regional, national, and international level. We're not going to solve the climate change problem if California acts alone. We need to bring along our regional partners. We need to bring along the rest of the country. We need to bring along the rest of the world in order to address the issue overall. And we have also recognized that the 2020 target, though it's extremely important and to a very large extent we built the plan around it, is just a way station on the way to reaching the more aggressive goals for 2050. Many of you have seen versions of this chart before, and so I'm not going to spend a lot of time walking through the details of it, but what I do want to emphasize, as Chuck had mentioned, the scope of the need to address greenhouse gas emissions is extremely broad. It covers pretty much all sectors of the California economy. The greenhouse gas emissions are particularly large from transportation and electricity, but there's sources throughout the California economy, and so that's why we've developed a comprehensive plan that we believe addresses all of the major sources going forward. It's also important, as I said, to recognize that the 2020 goal, while ambitious and important, is just a step on the way in order to have hope of stabilizing climate in the long term. It's going to be necessary to make much more severe reductions by 2050. Of the climate sciences, scientists believe that reductions on the order of 80% of emissions by 2050 are going to be necessary. And so the governor has set that as a target for California for 2050. As we developed the measures in the scoping plan, we were thinking not just about how do we meet the 2020 target, but are these measures, are these the programs and policies that we need in place in order to make sure the trajectory we have going forward gets us continued reductions through the 2020s and 30s and on towards 2050. Now, ARB is ultimately responsible for the development and adoption of the scoping plan itself, but this is not something that we could have done on our own by any means. We've had contributions from many other state agencies that are participating in the Climate Action Team and its various subgroups, and we've had a lot of input from the various advisory committees, the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, the Economic and Technology Advancement Advisory Committee, and the Market Advisory Committee. We also have had a lot of help and input from a lot of you folks and a lot of other stakeholders around the state. We've held numerous workshops, stakeholder meetings. We had a public solicitation last fall for ideas on how to get reductions. And so all of that input has been extremely important as we have been moved forward to develop the plan. So where are we in terms of development of the plan as we stand here today? We released the draft plan at last month's board meeting. We are still working on the appendices, which provide more information and detail on the various measures that we both have recommended and ones that we're still evaluating. We expect those appendices to be out in about a week or so. We're also continuing to work on the evaluation supplement that we're planning to release later this summer. That supplement will include information on the economic modeling we're doing and the evaluations we're doing of the environmental and public health and various other evaluations that are going to be an important underpinning of the plan that we take to the board this fall. We are asking for comments on the scoping plan itself, on the draft, by August 1st. And we recognize that since the appendices are not out, this will not give folks a lot of time to delve into the details of the appendices by the August 1st deadline. When we publish both the appendices and the evaluation supplement, we will be setting target dates for written comments on those documents as well. We ask people to recognize, though, that we are aiming to release the proposed scoping plan that we will end up taking to the board in November on October 3rd in order to start a 45-day comment period. So the earlier you're able to get comments into us, the more time we'll have to think about how to react to them, how to make changes from the draft plan to the proposed plan as we move forward. So we do encourage folks to get comments in, if at all possible, by August 1st. At the same time, this is not a formal proceeding, so it's not like after August 1st we're not going to take comments and not recognize what is said. It's just the earlier you get them into us, as I said, the more time we'll have to consider them. So once we have the proposed scoping plan out on the street in early October, that will start a 45-day comment period before it's considered by the board for possible adoption at the board meeting on November 20th. Now, I'm also guessing that a lot of you have seen this graphic as well, which lays out the timeline. I'm not going to spend a lot of time walking through the details. I do want to point out that it is, under AB 32, a very aggressive timeline for both adopting the scoping plan for many of the other steps that have been necessary, including the mandatory reporting rules, and establishing the 1990 baseline. Implementing regulations is also on a tight timeline. So far, we've been able to meet the deadlines in the bill, and we fully expect to be able to continue to meet the deadlines as we move forward. So with that, I'm going to start walking through the preliminary recommendations that we included in the plan itself, in the draft plan. So talking broadly, the overall recommendation is one of a mix of strategies that combine market mechanisms, regulations, voluntary measures, fees, and other programs. The key elements within this mix include a strong emphasis on energy efficiency programs. These are programs that we've had a lot of success with in California through the years, but we believe that there is still a lot more that can be achieved through energy efficiency. We are looking to achieving 33% renewables in the electricity mix by 2020. We're also recommending a California cap-and-trade program that would be linked to the Western Climate Initiative in order to create a regional cap-and-trade program. We're also looking at the implementation and, in some cases, strengthening of various existing laws and policies, including things like the Pavley Tailpipe Regulations, also known as California's Clean Car Standards. That's something that we have already adopted. We're still waiting to get a waiver from the U.S. EPA for that. We feel quite confident that in the early part of next year, we'll finally be able to implement the Pavley regulations. So far, there's been some holdups on that, but we're expecting to move forward. There's also goods movement measures that have already been adopted and are being developed in more detail. The low-carbon fuel standard is another one that we are looking to for helping achieve the targets. One of the things that we have included in the preliminary recommendation is that we will be moving forward this summer to start a fee regulation process. We're going to be adopting a fee, a relatively small fee, to help pay for the state's administration of the AB 32 program. So we're looking to for something that would be available to help pay for the salaries and other expenses as the state goes forward and implements this. So that's, in a nutshell, sort of the broad recommendations. Now we get to what is often one of the more complicated and confusing parts of the scoping plan, the interaction of the cap and trade program that we're talking about and a lot of the other regulations that we're planning to move forward with. So let me walk you through the structure of the draft plan from that perspective. We start with the red line, which is the 2020 projected business-as-usual emissions for greenhouse gases in California, which is 596 million metric tons. Not all of the sectors in the California economy would be part of the cap-and-trade system, so it's a subset of that 596 are the business-as-usual emissions for the sectors included in the cap-and-trade, and that subset is about 512. Now, as you look at the various recommended measures, the cap-and-trade system covers, by 2020, the transportation sector, the electricity sector, the natural gas sector, and the industry sector. A lot of the more specific measures address emissions in some of those sectors. Things like the Pavley tailpipe regulations will help lower transportation emissions, for example. When you look at those various measures, our projection brings the emissions in those sectors down to about 400 million metric tons. Now, we're layering over top of that the cap-and-trade system, and we're expecting to get additional reductions from the cap-and-trade system itself, which we believe can lower emissions in those sectors further down to 365 million metric tons. So when you're talking about the emission reductions in the sectors included in the cap-and-trade, it's every the overall reductions are from the 512 down to the 365. Some of those are gotten through the more direct measures. Others come directly from the cap and trade. Now, this table is in many ways the heart of the draft scoping plan itself. And when you see it in the document, as opposed to its relatively unreadable form up on the screen in front of you or on the handouts, it gives you a lot of very solid information. It lists all of the major measures that we are recommending for implementation as part of the scoping plan. It includes with that how much we expect in terms of emission reductions from the different measures. There's also some footnotes on a number of those numbers, which are for some of the measures that are what we call informally non-add, things like the water efficiency measures that are included. A lot of those reductions would actually come through reductions in the use of electricity or natural gas. So you can't add both the reductions from the water measures and the electricity and natural gas measures without some degree of double counting. So we've taken initial accounting of that and flagged the things where there's concerns along those lines with footnotes. You'll also notice that there is shading on a number of the numbers. Those are the emission reductions that are coming from sectors that are also included by 2020 in the cap and trade system itself. So there's a lot of solid information there. As I say, when you see it in the plan and can actually look at it up close, it's a very useful table and provides something of an overall roadmap and summary of the recommendations in the plan itself. So with that, I want to walk through a couple of the measures before turning the microphone over to John Costantino, who will walk through the rest of them. And we start in this with talking about the role of state government. And we recognize that as a government implementing AB 32, we are actually asking a lot of everyone in California in terms of getting greenhouse gas emission reductions. And we recognize that as the state government, we need to walk the walk and lead by example. So we have set a target for the state government in terms of emissions from our own operations of reducing 30% from business as usual emissions by 2020, essentially the same target that we're asking for the state as a whole. And there's a variety of ways that we believe that we can start achieving those reductions, things like the state Green Buildings Initiative, cleaning up the state's motor vehicle fleet, improving the procurement practices, and offering greater use of commute alternatives for state employees. These are a number of ways where we can reduce the carbon footprint of state government. We're also focusing to some degree on what we call the carbon shadow of state government. And the concept here is that there's a lot of areas where the government decision making, things like investment of the retirement funds, a lot of the long-term planning decisions, end up very much affecting the greenhouse gas emissions that are happening throughout the California economy. And so that's something that we believe that throughout government decision making, some consideration needs to be happening in terms of what will be the greenhouse gas implications of the investment decisions, of the policy decisions that are being made across the board. It's not that greenhouse gases will trump all other considerations in government decision making, but it definitely needs to be one of the key considerations going forward if we're going to be able to meet the targets and particularly keep things on trajectory for the 2050 target. The next thing that we talk about is the recommendation for a California cap and trade program that will link with other states and provinces in the Western Climate Initiative in order to create a regional market system. As we put this program together, it will be something that is a California program adopted under AB 32, and as such, we will be ensuring that the program meets all of the applicable requirements of AB 32. As we look at it, initially the capped sectors would include the electricity and industrial sectors, and we expect to expand it over time to include the commercial and residential use of natural gas and also transportation fuels. And those sorts of fuels would be done more at the distribution level rather than trying to get at, individual homes or, when you're fueling up your car. It would be more done through the distribution utilities or where the gasoline and diesel goes out into the from the wholesale to the retail market. Now, there are a lot of details that still need to be worked out in terms of what the cap and trade system will look like, but there's a number of key elements that are extremely clear that we will definitely be including and looking to make sure are extremely strong, starting with an enforceable cap on greenhouse gas emissions from the sources covered by the program starting in 2012. That cap would then continue to decline out to 2020 in order to get the needed emission reductions. And we also anticipate that this would be a longer-term program. One of the advantages is you have the infrastructure in place that by continuing to have the cap decline over time out towards 2050, you have a very important tool for making the longer-term targets. We expect to include a limited use of offsets within the program, and we'll talk a bit more about some of the meaning of that a bit later in the presentation. And then with the cap and trade program, like any regulatory program, one of the key things to making sure it works is that you have a strong enforcement and monitoring system in place. And finally, we're going to be looking very seriously at different ways of ensuring that there are safeguards in terms of making sure that there aren't any problems around the local or regional co-pollutants. With greenhouse gas emissions, there tend not to be direct public health or other environmental concerns beyond the global climate change. But often, because we're looking at reducing combustion, there's potential for strong environmental co-benefits from reducing other air pollutants and other sorts of things. So that's something we'll be taking a look at as we move forward. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to John Costantino to walk through the rest of the recommendations.
Good morning. Thanks, Kevin. So before I start diving into the actual, the measures, I just want a few opening remarks about a common theme that will be throughout all these measures, and the theme is efficiency. And you will see as we walk through the transportation and energy and some of the other industrial that it's about efficiency. It's about doing more with less, and so it's a common theme that you'll see scattered throughout. So if I use that word more than a couple dozen times, just let me know. One of the other things that Kevin mentioned is that there's a mix of markets and regulations and targeted fees, but there's also a mix of measures that are existing policy, existing state law, and new policies. So it's a little bit of new, a little bit of old, along with a little bit of regulation, a little bit of market. So it's got a whole bit of a mix there. So as we walk through it, you'll see what we're talking about. These measures were developed with the help of many other state agencies. This is not just an ARB plan. We were able to put it all together, but we couldn't have done it without many other state agencies that were helping us. And then one other thing that we'll talk about is this concept of tons versus trends. And some of the measures that are in here, we put in there just at a certain level because we knew we could quantify the reductions and pick a number that worked. Even though we knew that there was more tons available, we wanted to be a little bit conservative in this first draft. So there are tons still sitting on the table that we're still evaluating. Transportation is the number one source of emissions in the state of California. If you look back at that pie, you'll see that transportation is the largest source and by sector, and the largest category in that sector is the light-duty vehicle subsector. Then we've already have a law on the books, as Kevin mentioned, the PAVLI regulations, which attacks this head-on. We have not yet been able to implement it, but we feel confident that we can. AB 32 says that if we can't, because we when this law was passed, we already knew that there might be problems implementing it, that we have to backstop it with additional regulations and get those reductions. We can't just forget about them if this thing doesn't come to pass. So we have some items under consideration, which I'll walk through, that are meant to backstop PAVLI if we can't get there. We also have PAVLI 2, which is the next generation of greenhouse gas standards for light-duty vehicles, and that is being developed as we speak. That would not kick in until 2017 when the first PAVLI regulations would yield to that. The question, which is probably a good one, I use the terms interchangeably. PAVLI 1 is the 1493 waiver that EPA has not granted us permission. It's also the California Clean Car Standards. There's three or four names that it goes by. So PAVLI 1, 1493, or California Clean Car Standards are all interchangeably used for the same regulation. Thank you. There's other efficiencies you can do that for cars. You can that make them go further on the same tank of gas, and they include tire efficiency, other low-friction motor oils, and those are also in there to be evaluated as recommended measures. And then the last thing is high-speed rail. We know that the voters have to approve it, and it's got a long way to go, but it has the potential to be a very significant alternative for flying and long-distance trips throughout the state. So we think we can get a ton of reduction if the voters approve it, and it can start to be built by 2020. And then after that, it's kind of like cap and trade, where as it grows and gets bigger, you get bigger and bigger reductions in the out years by 2050. And then the next slide is about heavy duty trucks, and this is another category of the transportation sector. And trucks are 20% of the transportation sector, and the way you get at trucks is to do similar efficiency measures. You can make them more aerodynamic so they travel down the road easier. You can make them more efficient just in design from the beginning, or you can produce hybridized trucks, kind of like a Prius, and those would be most beneficial in an urban setting. Fuel is an important aspect of reducing transportation's carbon footprint, and we actually have an analogy that there's three legs to the transportation stool. There's the cars, the fuels, and the amount of miles they drive. And we just talked about the cars. We're going to talk about the fuels right now, and in a minute we'll talk about VMT, or vehicle miles traveled. We have an ongoing regulation that's the low carbon fuel standard, and the intent of the low carbon fuel standard is to reduce the carbon intensity of California's fuels by 10%. This is both gasoline and diesel, and includes alternative fuels as well. And the idea is that when you fill up your tank, it would be completely invisible to you, but your fuel would be cleaner. And we think we're going to take that to the board either at the very end of this year or the first part of next year. And that came out of an executive order from the governor, and it sort of is in parallel process with the scoping plan development. Okay. Now we head to goods movement, which is a subsector of the transportation sector. And goods movement is the movement of goods throughout the state. It starts with our ports, and it could be moving containers, or it could be moving agricultural products, or it could be moving things from north to south. And we have a lot of ongoing activities in this area, because when you attack this area, you also get the benefit of reducing diesel emissions, which is a health benefit for the communities around these areas. Drayage trucks, port electrification, and Prop 1B, which was a bond fund that was passed a few years ago that gave the state $1 billion to attack this. So those are the ongoing strategies. And then we have some new strategies of evaluating ways to improve the whole system, whether that's mode shift from truck to rail, or other means to move more freight with less fuel. Again, it's an efficiency measure. And vessel speed reduction is something that we're looking at for ships coming into California's waters. And as I said, there's significant co-benefits of criteria pollutants with that measure. So now we get to the next major sector of the California economy, which is energy. And energy ranks right behind transportation, and we have imported electricity and in-state electricity. But before you generate your electricity, if you can require less of it, that's a double win, and that's where energy efficiency comes in. If you make your houses, you make your factories, you make your businesses, your commercial places more energy efficient, then they need less energy. It's cheaper for the owners, and California has a history of making this work. They pay for themselves over time, and it's really a measure that we think should be promoted as one of the things we do no matter what happens. And traditionally, these are through utility-based programs, and we can rebates, that kind of thing. We can also go with additional building standards and appliance standards. And we have a solar water heater program in the state that is already in existence, and we think we can reduce natural gas usage through that program. The final thing on this slide is combined heat and power. And when you make heat and power with the same energy source, it's much more efficient than if you do it separately. So we want to encourage large industries and even small industries to go with combined heat and power facilities on site. Another existing program we have is the Million Solar Roofs program, and this uses the power of the sun to generate electricity. And it's a ratepayer-based financing program to try and install more megawatts of solar in the state. And when you do that, then it gets the ball rolling, it brings down the cost, and solar becomes more competitive. And the idea is, as we move forward, that solar is competitive with traditional methods of making electricity. And one of the key benefits that the Million Solar Roofs program has is it's a CEC program, and to receive your incentives, you also have to have additional energy efficiency on your house or your place of business. So it's a double win because you need less energy and you're producing your own energy. So it's one of those synergies that we think can happen with greenhouse gas targeted measures. One thing I haven't mentioned is that the California Public Utilities Commission and the California Energy Commission will be key players in adopting a lot of these energy regulations. This measure, the Energy Renewable Portfolio Standard, has received a lot of attention. It's an aggressive goal, but one that we think achieves significant reductions for the state. And right now we have a 20% mandate on our IOUs, which are our investor-owned utilities, and we envision that if you bump that up to 33% and include the POUs, which are the publicly owned utilities, the largest two being SMUD and Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, that we can achieve a significant reductions in greenhouse gases. So this measure has a lot of details still to be worked out as to exactly how it's going to work, but it's an aggressive goal that has lots of benefits as well as greenhouse gas reductions. And now we're back to the third leg of the transportation stool, which is the VMT reductions. And local governments have an important role to play. This slide actually should be two slides. And there's local government actions and regional greenhouse gas targets. When we speak of regional greenhouse gas targets, we are speaking of vehicle miles traveled. We're speaking of planning. We're speaking of growth. We're trying to figure out exactly how to make it so that people can not be so auto-focused and reduce the amount of miles they travel in any given year. Excuse me. And we would accomplish this through regional blueprints, be a comprehensive process. It considers other policy goals as well, sustainable living and getting people to have more access to walkable communities and that kind of thing. And so that's the regional greenhouse gas targets. The second half of this slide is the local government actions, which is cities, counties. They have their own carbon footprint and carbon shadows. They have their own fleets. They have their own codes. They have their own building standards. And so the policies that they implement have a great effect on greenhouse gases in the state. And when we speak of water and waste, a lot of those measures also have to go through the local governments. So local governments will play an important role in this plan. One thing about planning that is a benefit is once you build something, it stays around for a long time. So you get the cumulative benefits of what you did this year, you get it next year and the year after and the year after. So if we can start getting these benefits accumulating, then by 2020 and 2050, they have a significant impact. Now we're on to our industrial sources in the state. And industrial sources, by their nature, are stationary and fit well into a cap-and-trade system in that they're your traditional sources of air pollution that have been regulated over the years. One of the things we did in the plan was to require an energy audit of the large stationary sources in the state. This way, we can figure out where some of the old equipment is, where some of the inefficient equipment is, and from this energy audit, we can figure out the cost-effective, technologically feasible measures that will be useful to pursue. And when you when you reduce emissions at a stationary source, you also get the co-benefits that help out nearby residents with decreased fuel usage, and which is less criteria pollutants and less toxic air pollutants. This next category, high global warming potential gases, is completely unique, and it is things like refrigerants and foams and industrial chemicals that, when released in the atmosphere, have a potential they have a global warming potential that is sometimes many thousands of times higher than carbon dioxide or CO2. And so a little bit has a lot of damage. And because they are in your car, in your refrigerator, in the grocery store, in the foams that are used to insulate refrigerators, they're pretty much ubiquitous throughout the economy. And the regulations and the strategies to go after these are in the form of lots of little ones as opposed to a few big ones. Another unique thing about global warming gases is that they're already out there. Your refrigerator, which is a few years old or many years old, will eventually leak all its refrigerant, either now or in the future or when it's time to retire that refrigerator. So we call that concept a bank. There's a whole lot of emissions which are waiting to be released that are already out in commerce. So these are measures that, as I said, will take a lot of little efforts to try and to round them up over the next so many years. One possible approach is to have fees to discourage the use, or you have standards to prevent leakage, or you can substitute product if that's available. Now we get to recycling and waste. And as you can tell, this plan encompasses basically covers most of the California economy. And now we're getting into areas where it's a little harder to quantify, it's a little harder to piece together exactly where you're going to get your reductions. And this is where you get to the tons versus trends thought. And in our plan, we have 1 million metric ton of CO2 reduction equivalent for recycling and waste. But we know that there's a lot more tons to be had from this sector. And so we are looking at things like waste diversion, composting, commercial recycling, and manufacturer responsible requirements. And those measures we know will get additional tons, but we're not quantified for the plan. And so when you look at the plan, you'll see that we have a landfill methane control requirement. And then forests. When we get to this forest, it's unique in that it's an emitter of greenhouse gases and a reducer of greenhouse gases in that it sequesters carbon in the body of the trees. And so one of the things that we tried to figure out is what kind of role forests can play in the plan. And in California, we have 33 million acres of forest, but globally, forests play a major role in reducing CO2 emissions. So we wanted to make sure that we pointed out how important they were. In California, with climate change, with drought, with increased pests and wildfires, it's getting hard to maintain the amount of sequestration that the forests currently maintain, the forests currently have. So the goal is to maintain the amount of sequestration we have over the next 12 years. Without the measures in the plan, we think forests would no longer sequester carbon. They would basically be on balance neutral. So through forest management, wildfire prevention, afforestation, which is planting more trees, through those types of measures, we think we can increase forest sequestration. But it's also important to note that this is a much bigger issue outside of California, and we want to encourage that forests are strong and healthy and sustainable. Kevin mentioned the water-energy mix. It takes a lot of energy to get water to your home. You have to collect it, you have to move it, you have to treat it, and once you use it, you have to dispose of it and move it and that takes a lot of energy, whether it's electrical or natural gas. And so water energy is an important aspect of the plan, but because it's hard to tease out the kilowatt that was used to move the water versus the kilowatt that was used to flip on the light switch in your house, we've identified measures to reduce the amount of water, the amount of energy used, but to avoid double counting, we have not counted those emissions towards our goal. We know we have to pursue it. We know it's important, but we took a conservative approach with this. And then the last thing on this slide is one of the targeted fees that was mentioned earlier. And if you have a targeted fee like this, then you can take the proceeds from that fee and turn it back into measures that would do some of the things that are also listed: water efficiency, water recycling, system efficiency programs. One of the last slides I have in this section is about agriculture. And this is another one of the tons versus trends concepts. We put down one ton in the plan, and that ton would be for digesters in 2020. But we know that there's a lot of potential for agriculture to reduce emissions and to be part of the solution, whether it's general efficiency in their operations, the reduced use of diesel, fuel, things that will pay for themselves, things that agriculture can do. Nothing is required at this time in the plan, but we think that with some more research and some more reviewing that there's some possibilities here. So everything I covered up to this point was preliminary recommendations, things that we want to pursue and things that are in one part of the plan. These next set of slides are things that we consider to be under evaluation, and these are things where we didn't either have enough data or confidence, or we are still trying to figure out some of the details before we put them as preliminary recommendations. And we have some of these measures for each of the sectors I previously described. Transportation, there's some market-based strategies, fee-baits, and the fee-bait idea would actually be one of the primary ideas to backstop the PAVLI regulations. So if we didn't get authorization to do the PAVLI regulations, then fee-baits might be able to fill that gap. Electricity and energy, one of the things that we could do is be much more aggressive in our energy efficiency programs and reduce our coal-fired electricity. So coal power plants have a high CO2 footprint. And so if we can reduce the use of coal, then we would reduce the CO2 per megawatt. Again, it's sort of an efficiency metric. And then in California has a lot of industry, including cement plants, refineries, glass manufacturers, and they have boilers and engines and process heaters. And if we can make those more efficient, if you can get rid of the old stuff that's been around forever, again, you can save money and reduce greenhouse gases. Kevin mentioned offsets before, and offsets are something we're evaluating. It's a market measure. And the first use of offsets, which are emission reductions from sources that are not covered by the cap and trade program. So if you reduce your emissions and not in the cap and trade program, then that's potentially a source of offsets. And they can be an attractive way to reduce emissions from things that are either hard to regulate, or you can get emission reductions early because there's an incentive for people to reduce their emissions. For offsets to be part of the program, they have to meet certain criteria. And those criteria include that they be real, permanent, quantifiable, verifiable, enforceable, and additional. And the word additional implies that we would not otherwise require you to reduce that emission. There are two major types of offsets. One are voluntary. So if you've heard people who are flying, they want to reduce their carbon footprint, or companies that are trying to be carbon neutral will buy offsets And those offsets are slightly different than what we would call regulatory offsets, which would have to be much more scrutinized and verified by the Air Resources Board. And the Air Resources Board would have to adopt rules which would specify which categories of sources would be allowed for offsets and how they could be used. As Kevin mentioned, you could use your offsets within the cap and trade program, or you could use your offsets for regulatory compliance if that regulation allowed for it. And the use of offsets will be limited in the plan. That's the preliminary recommendation. So the idea being, we want to get the technologies, we want to get the energy efficiency, we want to get the co-benefits, and not just allow people to buy offsets to meet their carbon reduction obligations. The next thing that we're evaluating is the idea of a carbon fee. And a carbon fee is an economic measure, an economic mechanism similar to the cap and trade by putting a price on carbon. And the key difference is when you put a price on, when you put a carbon fee on CO2, then you have a set dollar amount that you know it's going to cost, but you're not so sure about the emission reductions that are associated with it. Whereas a cap and trade, you know what the emission reductions are going to be because you've capped them, but the price at which you get those reductions is unknown. So for environmental certainty, the cap and trade program has more as a bigger benefit. The other thing with carbon fees is that they can be targeted to do certain things. We talked about the water public discharge as one possibility. Another more limited use of carbon fees that was also mentioned is the administrative support for the program. And AB 32 provides the fee authority to the Air Resources Board to adopt those fees so the program can continue on and provide for the enforcement and implementation that's necessary. That discussion that we just talked about carbon fees and the things we've talked about leads directly into how we would use any proposed revenues that we received, which could be substantial. The ETAC, which is the Economic and Technology Advisory Advancement Committee, recommended the creation of a carbon trust that might help play a role in distributing the program revenues throughout California. The idea is that the revenues would be used for the public good. There's a variety of uses that you could come up with. I won't read the list, but they're on the slide. And this will be an extremely important and contentious issue that we are seeking comment on. When you have large sums of money, there's a lot of good you could do with it, and a lot of different ways you could spend that. So we are asking for comments on this in particular, even though we're asking comments for the whole plan. If there's an area that you think would be useful to submit comments on, this might be a good one. And with that, as I come to a close, Edie Chang will take you through the rest of the program. Thank you.
Okay, so you're almost done having to listen to us talk about this, and you can all have your say. What I'm going to talk about is the evaluations that are required in the scoping plan. AB 32 requires a whole series of evaluations. They kind of fall real broadly into economic evaluations that are required, and then non-economic evaluations, which is a real umbrella term for environmental evaluations, public health evaluations, as well as societal impacts. So I'm going to just briefly talk about what we have in the draft scoping plan right now, as well as a supplementary evaluation that's going to be coming out later this summer. We are still performing some of these analyses As we, you know, finalize the details of the preliminary recommendation, we didn't have time to complete all of the analyses and wanted to make sure that we didn't sort of take any shortcuts on that. On the economic side, we have done an initial look at the potential economic impacts. And what we see when we look at the measures that are in the preliminary evaluation that is on net, we think that there are going to be significantly more savings than costs associated with the measures in the scoping plan. This is because the measures focus in large part on energy efficiency programs that will largely save consumers money, and also about and also focusing on transitioning to non-petroleum alternatives, which in a time like this when petroleum prices are very high, impacts the cost. As I mentioned, many of the efficiency measures that are in the plan are likely to save consumer costs in the long run. And one of the examples that we like to use, because it's a regulation that's already been adopted into law, is these Pavli car standards. When we look at the Pavli car standards, someone buying one of these cars that's more fuel efficient is going to save about $30 a month in fuel costs, even when you consider the fact that the car was going to be more expensive when they bought it up front. So as we look at other kinds of programs that are in the preliminary recommendation, like energy efficiency programs, appliance efficiency programs, we expect to see the same kinds of things. And as I mentioned, there are some additional analyses that are underway. We're using a series of economic models to look at the economics of the staff's preliminary recommendation, and we'll be doing the same kinds of analyses for the staff's proposal later this year. The first two models that we're using are called EDRAM and VAIR. These are macroeconomic models, so they look at the whole California economy, and they can evaluate changes in gross state product, changes in employment. They look at different sectors of the economy, income, prices, changes in household income, and they can stratify that by different income groups. And so these, like I said, are broad macroeconomic models. The other model that we're using is Energy 2020. And this is a more specific model for North America, which we're tuning for California. And this, what this model does is it looks at how energy flows through the economy. And we're calibrating it to California. And one of the things that we want to do is to use these models together. Basically, the outputs of the energy flow model of Energy 2020 can be used as inputs to the macroeconomic models. And so what we want to do is sort of iterate, use the outputs from EDRAM and VAIR, put them back into Energy 2020, and we think we're going to get a better picture of what could potentially happen under different possible scenarios. So the kinds of things that we're going to be looking at are the preliminary staff recommendation and what the potential economic impacts would be, and we also want to look at a few other scenarios. If we just used regulations, if we could come up with enough just straight regulations that would focus on specific sectors, what might that do to the economy? What sorts of industries would, how would it affect different kinds of industries? And then we also want to model a broad carbon fee. As John mentioned, you know, the broad carbon fee is something that many folks have talked about in the California debate as well as the national debate, and we think it's important for us to take a look at what could the potential impacts if we pursued that kind of strategy. And then we also are, AB 32 asks us to take a specific look at small businesses and what the potential impacts of the scoping plan might be on small businesses, so we will be doing that. On the environmental and public health analysis, I think it's important to place this program in the context of the Air Resources Board's broader programs that have been ongoing for the past 40 years. As residents of the Valley, I'm sure you know there's a real strong partnership between the Air Resources Board and the local air districts working on smog programs, particulate programs, and air toxics programs, particularly with regard to diesel particulate programs. And as we look at AB 32, we think that it also has the potential to help us make continued progress on our public health goals as well. To the extent that we see fuel use decreasing because folks are using energy more efficiently and because we're transitioning to non-petroleum alternatives, we would expect to see improvements in public health as well. We've done an initial evaluation. If you look at reduced fuel use as a result of the staff's preliminary recommendation, with the exception of the cap and trade program. That one's a little harder because we didn't know exactly, you know, how folks would comply with it. But if you look at just the programs excluding cap and trade, we're looking at something on the order of about a $2 billion $2 billion in public health impacts from the proposed scoping plan. Now, this is a sort of a top-down analysis. We've looked at the measures and said, how much fuel statewide do we think would, how would fuel use change? We are also taking a deeper dive into this for the environmental and public health analysis. We're looking at the proposed measures. So for each type of measure, we're looking at what the potential air impacts would be, water resource impacts, land resources, waste disposal and hazardous waste, as well as biological resources. And then based on the output of that environmental analysis, we'll be doing a public health evaluation to see what are the potential public health impacts of the proposed scoping plan. We've gotten a lot of feedback about concern about how the AB 32 and the proposed or the draft scoping plan may affect certain kinds of sources in certain sectors. And so we are going to take a closer look at things like refineries and power plants to look at what the potential impacts in those sectors might be, depending on how what the staff's recommendation is and then how it's actually implemented in the real world. And then at the request of the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, we are looking at a community-level emission analysis, so trying to take a community and looking at the sources in that area and trying to figure out how those sources might address any sort of regulatory scenario that we put together and what would the emission impacts of those scenarios be. So it's something that's new. We haven't done it before. But it's something that's of concern to some of the, especially the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, so it's something that we said we would take a shot at and see how far we can get. AB 32 also requires ARB to look at the societal impacts of regulations before they are approved. Although this is a requirement when we're doing the actual regulatory part of the AB 32 process, we thought it made sense for us to look at the societal impacts of the draft plan and of the proposed plan, since it really sets the framework for what's going to come in the future. We're going to consider factors such as energy diversity, mobility, how does it affect people's ability to get around, regressivity or the impact on low-income households, as well as job creation. And then there's another portion of AB 32. It's section 38565, which is sort of a community empowerment section. And it directs the ARB, as we're developing climate change programs, to consider ways to direct both public and private investment towards the most disadvantaged communities. And we're in the process of setting up a stakeholder group to try to figure out the best way to implement that provision of the law as we're moving forward on not only moving towards a proposed scoping plan recommendation, but also as we're looking at implementing the plan in the long run. As I mentioned, most of these analyses are still in progress, and we will have an evaluation supplement available over the summer, which is going to pull together the results of the economic modeling, the environmental, the public health analyses. After the supplement is released later this summer, we will have a workshop to have another opportunity to chat with us specifically about the evaluation supplement. And, of course, we always welcome written comments. And as Kevin mentioned, we will have a due date specifically for comments about the evaluation, recognizing that folks are going to need some time to digest it and be able to get their thoughts together to give us cogent comments on that. And we do want to get written comments so that we can incorporate that input into the analyses that we're doing on the proposed plan that will be released in October. So we've talked a little bit about how we're all aiming towards 2020, and it's an ambitious goal. But as Kevin mentioned, 2020 is really sort of a way station on the way to 2050, to where we really need to end up going, which is about an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. The scoping plan, the draft, is really designed to lay the foundation for this cleaner, more energy secure future as we go forward. I know we're all very focused on the end of this year as the time we're going to have a scoping plan for the board to consider and that the board will act on, but it really is only the beginning. Any of you who have been involved in any kind of plans before, whether they're state implementation plans or district clean air plans or transportation plans or any kind of plans, know that a plan is only as good as its implementation. And so the real work really begins at the beginning of it's already begun. We're going to initiating a fee regulation to fund the administrative costs of implementing AB 32. So this is the salaries for the folks that are working on the climate change program. Once the scoping plan is approved, ARB and the other state agencies that have to do rulemakings have 2 years to adopt the regulations that are required to implement AB 32. And that's not a very long period of time when you consider how long it takes to do a rulemaking in a technically sound way that provides as much opportunity for public comment as we feel is important to do at the Air Resources Board. So that's going to be a pretty rigorous and extensive process, but we have every intention of following our normal public process and providing a lot of input, providing opportunities for a lot of input from stakeholders. And then, of course, the implementation of those regulations and the enforcement of those regulations is going to be a real critical component as we're moving forward. And since any plan is only as good as its implementation, you have to know how you're doing on your implementation. So the Air Resources Board is going to have to be involved in monitoring how we're moving forward on implementation. There's actually a legislative requirement for every state agency that's involved in climate change to submit an annual report card on how they're doing on meeting their obligations, whether it's in the Climate Action Team's original report or in the scoping plan. So you'll have an opportunity as members of the public on an annual basis to see how are we all doing in meeting these very ambitious goals that we've set out. And then the law recognized that plans are living documents that need to evolve and change to meet new requirements and the new realities. I don't think there's a plan alive that has anticipated every single thing that could possibly happen. And so the law requires that we go back and revisit the plan every 5 years to true it up and make mid-course corrections as we need to. As we move forward, one of our challenges is how to engage all Californians in our climate change battle as we move forward. Californians are responding to the challenge. Lots of local governments have stood up and they signed on to the U.S. Mayor's climate challenge. And really the successful implementation of AB 32 is going to require all of us, citizens, government, businesses, local governments, all working together. And this is really, for the ARB, sort of a new thing. It's really a multi-generational challenge that we need to make sure that we're also reaching out as part of the educational system and to children, because this is a challenge that's going to take decades for us to really address. Now, in closing, I just want to put up this slide, which provides some websites that have additional places that you can get information. The first one is the ARB's climate change site, and that's where you can download the scoping plan if you don't have one, or send links to your friends. If you want information about the Climate Action Team, particularly what other state agencies are doing about climate change, the California Climate Change Portal is the best place to start. And then I specifically wanted to point out the last website. We turned this website on June 26th when we released the draft scoping plan. And this is the place to go to provide formal comments into the draft scoping plan process. It's a site that's really similar to how we handle our normal board commenting. If you've done that before, you log on to the site, you click that you want to submit a comment. There's a place that you can either type your comment or you can attach a file. So if you have a letter, you can attach that. And then all of the comments are posted onto our website. So you can also see what other folks are thinking about the plan and the kinds of things that other folks are saying. The site is set up so that you can provide either general comments or you can provide comments on a specific sector, a specific industry, or on the program design of the AB 32 program. So we're going to leave this site up all summer. As Kevin mentioned, even though we have requested comments by August 1st, we're not going to turn the switch on August 2nd and say no more comments. We're always interested in what folks have to say. But of course, the earlier you get us your comments, the more likely we're going to be able to consider them as we move forward. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Chuck.
Thanks, Edie. And thanks also to John and Kevin for your presentation. Well, that's a lot of material to sit through, and appreciate your patience, but it gives an indication of the breadth and the scale of what is involved in moving forward on AB 32 implementation and some of the things that we're wrestling with and the areas where we welcome public comment. Before going further, I would just like to acknowledge the presence of Dr. Tellis in the back row there. He's one of our board members who has joined us and will be providing comment a little bit later. Yeah. He wants to hear what everyone has to say, and he'll have some of his own comments later just as part of the normal process, but I wanted to acknowledge his presence. So now we're going to start in with public comment. A couple of things. As I mentioned, we're going to have a four-minute limit out of consideration for the number of people that are here and the desire to work through all of the information. We have numbers, so we'll just be calling off numbers. When your number is called, just go to the mic that's there, and could you please identify yourself before you begin your comments? And one other thing I'd like to add, I guess, is it's really useful for us if you focus on things you want us to change, you know, do or not do, to target the comments as much as possible as recommendations to staff as we're going forward for things to consider, things we might have missed, things that you heard that you don't like, things that you heard that you do like. But in the context of, you know, if you were sitting here having to draft this, what would you do? That's what makes it most useful for us as we're going forward. Of course, you know, we're interested in whatever observations people have, but focusing them on changes or amendments to the plan is really what's quite helpful. And the reason I'm saying that is that this is a draft. We've characterized it as a draft plan. These are preliminary recommendations. We think what we have put forward makes sense and is self-contained. When you look at the totality of it, it's a sound approach towards trying to hit these 2020 targets within the meaning of AB 32. So, you know, we're proud of what we've done, but we certainly recognize that it could be improved. And so we're looking for comment from the public now and throughout the process as to what we might do to try and make a better plan that better achieves all the different requirements of AB 32. So with that, I guess we'll go ahead and get started. And is comment number one? I know there were some of these are out or not out.
We don't have a clock that we can see, but I've got my cell phone with the stopwatch on it. So I'm going to time it, and what I was going to plan to do is give folks like a 1 minute and then 30 second and then try to signal you when the time is up, and we'll try to be pretty even throughout in fairness for everybody.
Great, thank you. So our first speaker, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Hello, I'm Tom Bond, Chair for the Off-Road.
Pardon me, I think we need to turn that mic on.
I think we do, too.
Oh.
Up? That's up. Hello, I'm Tom Bond, Chair for the Off-Road Vehicle Subcommittee for the Sierra Club Santa Margarita Chapter in Southwest Riverside County. We say no more free pass for off-road vehicles. It is simply amazing that you missed this huge sector. Why do we still allow heavy polluting two-stroke four-wheelers and motorcycles to race through California's forests and deserts? One two-stroke vehicle pollutes 118 times more greenhouse emissions than a car in 1 hour of driving. A four-stroke emits seven times more. Imperial County, where the desert recreation areas are mostly located, has the largest amount of respiratory disease in the state. due to airborne pollutants. In 2006, over 26 million gallons of gasoline were burned up by registered off-road vehicles on public lands in California. We ask you to make them all CARB compliant as soon as possible. Please read the new document, Fuel to Burn, the climate and public health implications of off-road vehicle pollution in California, produced by CBD, the Center for Biological Diversity. Let me just quote something here on page 30. Just take a minute. This is their conclusion. The California Air Resources Board must place recreational off-road vehicle pollution on the table with emissions from automobiles, smokestacks, and other polluters. The state must take immediate action to prevent off-road vehicle pollution from continuing to jeopardize the public health of California residents, contributing to disastrous changes in climate and otherwise harming California's natural and cultural heritage. I would like all of you members to please try and get a copy of this. It was put out in May of 2008, and it is an excellent document. This is what it looks like if you haven't seen it yet. Lastly, please redesign a responsible yet usable gas can. I recently went out to the desert to monitor the shenanigans of off-road vehicle people, and I watched a motorhome refuel with a 5-gallon CARB-compliant gas can. I'll bet more than 2 gallons of fuel spilled on the sides of his motorhome and onto the ground, and of course also polluted our air. Thank you very much.
I don't think we have anyone from Mobile Source here. Are any of us familiar with status of work on off-road? Yeah. Okay, well, again, thank you very much for that comment. We'll track down that report, pass it along to the staff working in that area. Good, thank you. Number two.
My name is Philip Arrow. My name is Philip Arrow. Is it Gary? No? I'm an almond grower, there it is, in western Fresno County. I'm also a member of the board of the San Joaquin Valley Clean Energy Organization. That organization was created by the California Partnership for the San Joaquin Valley. It operates as a regional hub for communication and resource leveraging to increase the adoption of energy efficiency and renewable energy technologies in the San Joaquin Valley. For 30 years, California has implemented energy conservation, energy efficiency, and renewable energy initiatives, resulting in economic growth without increasing per capita energy consumption. California Energy Commission buy-down incentives enabled the purchase of solar photovoltaic systems for my residence in Almond Orchard, which has shifted 65% of my power usage to solar electricity. Compared to a Tier 3 diesel engine, my solar PV-fueled electric drip irrigation booster pump, 60 horsepower or 45 kilowatts, avoids emitting 983 pounds of NOx and 48 pounds of particulate matter per year. To see a video of my solar farm solar system, I give a link in this presentation. My solar photovoltaic powered water pump can be replicated tens of thousands of times throughout California. Post AB32 venture capital investments in solar photovoltaic concentrated and biomass to fuel technologies in California clearly yield cleaner air a reduction in carbon emissions, and a vibrant economy. The Air Resources Board's emphasis on energy efficiency and water efficiency is crucial to California agriculture. I wholeheartedly support the ARB scoping plan goals of reducing California energy consumption by 32,000 gigawatt hours and natural gas usage by 800 million therms by 2020. I believe that reducing per capita consumption of water by 20% by 2020 is imperative given the population growth projected for the next 12 years. In the agriculture sector, water efficiency and water system energy efficiency are essential for sustainability. Pumping water to irrigate crops consumes 80% of the electricity California farms use, minimizing the amount of water needed to irrigate starts with building soil carbon to attain moisture retention. When sufficient soil carbon sustains abundant microorganisms, moisture remains in the soil root zones and maximizes the amount of water available for crop production.
Baseline water needs, sir. 1 minute left.
The point here is that the baseline for water needs for crops is reduced, and the size of the pumping system can be accordingly reduced. I'm going to skip on to the last point, and that is the renewable portfolio standard of 33% is extremely important. In my case, I have a 28.8 kilowatt solar PV power water pump. It saves $8,000 per year in electric charges, but if PG&E were required to pay me 5 cents per kilowatt hour for the 56,000 kilowatt hours I produce per year for renewable energy credits, that would add a revenue of $2,800 to my revenue stream. That's a 35% increase. So this would incentivize more systems such as mine. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate what you're doing. I mean, that just sounds like you're a real leader in this area. Very much appreciate it. And also thank you for sticking to the time. Again, these formats aren't the greatest for allowing extended discussion, but given the great interest here and the large number of people that want to speak, we really do think, you know, we owe it to everybody to keep to the limits, and I very much appreciate what you've done. Speaker number three, please.
Good morning. I'm Gary Schultz, Program Director of the Claude Laval Water and Energy Technology Incubator, a program of the Central Valley Business Incubator, a private nonprofit 501c3 organization. Our location is 2911 East Barstow on the California State University Fresno campus, and I personally reside at 1508 East Boyer in Tulare. Our incubator program in Fresno has assisted hundreds of businesses and produced thousands of jobs in its 12-year existence. In March of 2007, we opened the Claude Laval Water and Energy Technology Incubator as a partnership with the International Center for Water Technology at Fresno State, with the hope of establishing Fresno as the world-class leader in water and energy technology development. It is equipped with solar technology to capture enough energy that we are a net energy provider to the PG&E grid. The purpose of this water and clean energy technology incubator is to identify and recruit startup businesses that through our business assistance become wildly successful, profitable, and large employers. The assistance we lend deals with things like strategic business planning, human resources, legal, organizational, capitalization, bookkeeping and accounting, marketing, manufacturing, and distribution. Our goal is that within the 6 to 24 month window in which the business is an incubator member, they launch as a successful, profitable, standalone employer. On the average, only 44% of startup businesses survive the first 4 years. With incubator coaching, direction, guidance, and assistance, we double that, and the National Business Incubator Association documents that 87% of incubator businesses survive the first 5 years. Our clean energy and water technology companies that we assist are truly developing world-class life-changing innovations. One company, PureSense Environmental, winner of the World Ag Expo Top 10 New Products Award, uses real-time technology to tell the farmer when his water level in his orchard or vineyard is too wet or too dry so that pumping may be appropriately adjusted, saving labor, water, and energy while greatly increasing yields. Another, OxyPro, has developed technology that enhances automobile engine fuel efficiency while extending engine length of life and reducing sulfur, nitrogen, and carbon emissions. Another company, World Water and Solar, is replacing diesel-powered irrigation pumping engines with solar power, complete with technology to continue pumping when the power grid might go down. At the Claude Laval Water and Energy Technology Incubator, we believe we are launching companies with the innovations necessary to make a difference in California's efforts to conserve water and profitably develop clean air alternatives. Additional research and investor funding is a critical element in the immediacy of our success. More funding means quicker and wider introduction of these technologies to the marketplace, and any assistance or collaboration available from the Air Resources Board is greatly appreciated. Thanks.
Thank you very much. It's great to hear good news once in a while. You know, we, in this area so often, we hear the challenges, but it's refreshing here in the last speaker, and I'm sure other speakers to come. It's great to hear so much that's happening to try and take a bite out of this issue. Speaker number four, please.
Good morning. My name is Peter Cooper with the California Labor Federation. I work with the Workforce and Economic Development Program at the Labor Federation. The Labor Federation represents over 2 million union workers in the state in all areas of the economy, from longshore workers to machinists to teamsters, hotel workers, service workers, all spread out throughout the economy. And this is important because labor not only wants to be here and be part of this reaching a solution, we feel it's intrinsical that we're part of the solution, reaching a solution, because our members are strewn throughout the economy and they know how things work at the ground level, at the shop floor level. So we have over 2 million members. We're organized in such a way that we have 23 regional bodies called Central Labor Councils. And later this morning, you probably will hear from the leader of our regional Central Labor Council, the Fresno Central Labor Council, Randy Gann. So I want to say that, first of all, we appreciate that the Air Resources Board has begun to increase the outreach to labor unions and really bring us into these discussions. And we look forward to further dialogue about how we can be part of the solution and working towards those goals. Specifically, I wanted to mention one thing about the scoping plan and the economic analysis. The economic analysis, the models so far, have really not gone down to the level of analysis that we would like to see. Specifically, we would like to have a better idea of the impact on the labor market and the impact on the skills and job training needs that will be required to reach some of the goals. One other specific item that kind of jumped into my awareness was that we have a number of union members that do not have English as their first language, and much of the material that I've seen so far has been only in English. I'm sure that there are some documents that are in Spanish and other languages, but we would like to see more. And lastly, I just want to suggest that the board consider putting a recommendation into the scoping plan that would call for the expansion of the Air Resources Board to include folks from impacted segments of our population. This would be people of color. This would be immigrant communities. This would be people from the environmental justice community, and also representatives from labor unions. We'll be submitting some specific written comments later in the process. But I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Speaker 5. Speaker 6. Oh, okay. Those weren't taken. Speaker 7. Was that? No, it wasn't. Okay, Speaker 8.
My name is Mukasa Kezala. I'm just a general interest. I'm not associated with anybody. I'll make my comments when the appendices are issued, because this is kind of dry. But one thing I'd like to point out is I'm very happy with the section on public outreach is put together and education. And there's very little I could add to this. I'm very familiar with government programs, and they really fail to reach the people they need to reach. They make all these fancy brochures, and they really don't get out to the people on the field. But this one here, I wish you had followed this, what you recommend right to do here, for these meetings. Otherwise, for a regional meeting, really, we shouldn't have these empty seats. We should have gone out to the non-profits, we should have gone out to the churches, we should have gone out to the trade groups and really told them about this meeting. That way they could get on the ground floor. That way they could have buy-in. But I don't think that was done. So anyway, this is commendable, the way you have it laid out, and I hope you really do it for your next meeting. The other point I'd like to touch on is I've got an interest in energy issues. The speaker number 2 made a comment about not getting money for when his meter is turning backwards, the equivalent of meter turning backwards. That is a sole item with a lot of people that like solar energy. They would like to get some money for their effort. If that was looked into a bit further, maybe that would be an incentive for people to go solar more. Also, people who consider cogen, one of the things they run into is obstacles thrown into their way by the utilities. Somebody needs to look into that and remove those obstacles. That way small businesses can use cogen technology. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And with respect to your first comment, we are holding these large public workshops, but we're also holding other meetings around the state. This is sort of a piece of a larger puzzle, but I do appreciate your comment in terms of outreach even for these large public meetings, and we'll endeavor to reach out as much as we can. With respect to the energy and the cogen, this issue of barriers to cogeneration is something that's very much part of what we're looking at as we're looking at how to increase the use of cogeneration in the state. And there are some, there are working groups. There's people taking a look at that issue. But, yes, there are some very real issues associated with that. Speaker number 9, please.
Good morning. My name is Dennis Hall. I represent the American Lung Association of California. I'd like to commend the work that CARB has accomplished so far in developing the scoping plan, and we genuinely appreciate the serious focus on public health protections. However, we do have some suggestions for strengthening those components. As you're aware, California is facing a public health crisis. The state is experiencing 14,000 to 24,000 premature deaths from air pollution yearly, 335,000 asthma attacks, and 2 million missed school days from children suffering from these asthma attacks, thousands of hospitalizations and emergency room visits, and reduced lung function growth in children each year due to air pollution. These grim numbers should remind us that the tools and strategies that are adopted to implement AB 32 have real and dramatic consequences or benefits for Californians. It is therefore important that that California take seriously that we must not only reduce greenhouse gases, but simultaneously make substantial progress on lowering criteria and toxic pollution. The dual goal can be accomplished by carefully packaging greenhouse gas reduction programs together to obtain the maximum amount of health protections. Nonetheless, there is still strengthening to the scoping plan that will be needed to acquire the maximum benefits. As such, we urge you to include additional strong regulatory measures on industrial sources in order to reduce emissions from petroleum refineries, cement manufacturers, certain portions of the agricultural sector, and others. We urge you to look at what additional efficiencies and emission reductions can be obtained from the goods movement sector. We also need to have more significant focus on progressive measures that local government can adopt to reduce vehicle miles traveled. We feel it important that the plan demonstrate that a mix of measures will provide local benefits in terms of air quality and public health. We strongly support directing additional resources and revenue to environmental justice communities and address these issues, and hope that the plan will not result in disproportionate impacts of hot spots of pollution. Therefore, we are pleased that CARB is planning to release a summary to the scoping plan that addresses cumulative and localized impacts. A public health assessment is a key strategy to ensure that health protections are maximized in the scoping plan, and that CARB intends to carefully evaluate the local health impacts of all measures and strategies in the plan in order to determine the most effective measures. We continue to be very concerned about the use of market mechanisms in the plan. We believe the programs must be approached cautiously and, if adopted, must be limited in scope. Additionally, we need to ensure that pollution sources pay for their allowance allocations rather than allowing a free distribution of allowances. In conclusion, we would like to see the plan strengthen measures that will reduce emissions from the transportation sector. The American Lung Association recommends that the development of strong regional greenhouse gas reduction targets as a crucial measure to ensure that local governments make the changes necessary in land use transportation planning to support compact and more efficient development. The expansion of public transit as a key strategy in the plan, which should include providing full funding of public transportation in the state budget this year and providing consistent ongoing funding and critical, ongoing funding that is critical for these measures and to promote reduced need for driving. An acceleration of efforts to bring more zero-emission vehicles to the market is crucial. CARB needs to establish measures to increase ZEVs in the market by establishing more aggressive goals for introducing battery electric vehicles and fuel cell vehicles into the vehicle fleet, and establishing requirements for automakers to expand the use of electric drive technologies across new vehicle fleet, including conventional hybrid and plug-in hybrid technologies. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Speaker number 10, please.
My name is Keith Bergfold. I am the Assistant Director for Planning at City of Fresno. I appreciate the gentleman's comments to the previous speaker. He kind of gave me a segue into speaking to you about the role of land use in climate change and climate stabilization. There's a book I know all of you have read called Growing Cooler, and it is one of the best studies that we've seen that emphasizes the role of land use and transportation planning, especially at the metropolitan level, in achieving climate stabilization. I've handed out to you some work. There's also a number of website links, and I've got handouts back on the table for people who would like to be able to get to our website. This is the Southeast Growth Area Plan that the City of Fresno is engaged in with Peter Calthorpe and EDA Associates. This is a climate stabilization plan. It addresses directly greenhouse gas reductions, air quality improvements, reductions in the use of energy and water, compact development, and I think it's probably the greenest plan that's emerging in California today. I think you should look at this. We want you to understand that the City of Fresno is attempting and needs the wind at its back from all of our state agencies to get this done, to achieve compact development and transit systems, smart growth, and other systems that would save all of these resources and produce exactly what your scoping plan is intended to produce. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. What was your name again, please, sir?
Keith Bergthold, B-E-R-G-T-H-O-L-D, and it's actually on the last page of that first handout.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Thanks.
And Jeff Weir over here in the blue is our point person on these issues.
Great.
So sounds like yep, you guys have
we would appreciate the chance to explore this more with you when you have the opportunity. And we do think that in terms of looking at the scoping plan, land use is an issue, and its impact on what you're trying to achieve is not as emphasized as we would like it to be.
Just So do you have a sense that there are more tons available than what we're taking credit for 2020? Or
well, not for 2020, but certainly okay. beyond that. And land use has a long lead time.
Yes.
But we think it's critical towards the long-term solution, and I didn't see it in the scoping plan, frankly.
Okay, thank you very much. Speaker number 11.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Betsy Reif-Snyder, and I'm with Catholic Charities, Diocese of Stockton. But today, I was asked to represent California Interfaith Power and Light, and our diocese is a member congregation. And first of all, I'd just like to acknowledge the hard work and the dedication of the staff in developing the scoping plan. Thank you very much for your good work. California Interfaith Power and Light is an interfaith environmental ministry dedicated to working with California's faith community to address the grave threat to humanity and all of creation posed by global warming. CIPL has more than 500 member congregations here in California and is a part of the national Interfaith Power and Light programs that are operating in 26 of our states. In 2006, California Interfaith Power and Light worked for passage of AB 32, and our member congregations have already prevented over 20 million pounds of carbon dioxide emissions from entering the atmosphere through energy efficiency measures. So California Interfaith Power and Light, or CIPL as we like to call it, wants to make sure that implementation of AB 32 is just, that it's fair, and that it's effective. To that end, we urge the Air Resources Board to embrace the following elements in the final scoping plan and also with any collaboration that you have with the Western Climate Initiative. First of all, ensure that any plan to distribute carbon emission allowances and revenues is done in a fair and equitable manner. Under the potential use of revenues that you had showed us earlier, we urge that you designate a portion of the allowances or revenues from allowance auctions to assist low-income people in adapting to AB 32 through intensive energy efficiency programs, transportation alternatives, and bill payment assistance. And I was specifically asked by the staff at CIPL to let you know that CIPL does not support free giveaways of allowances. CIPL's position is that polluters should pay the full cost of the pollution that they cause. The third point, ensure that working people can transition to new green jobs and that worker retraining is available for this purpose. And finally, to ensure that the Western Climate Initiative scope includes transportation fuels in order to maintain an environmental integrity to any work by the Western Climate Initiative and to achieve the lowest cost economy-wide emission reductions. I believe there will also be a California Interfaith Power and Light representative at the Sacramento hearing, and I know that we will be providing written formal comments, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. Speaker number 12, please.
My name is Gordon Knipp. I'm the vice chair of the Kern Cahuilla chapter of the Sierra Club, and I live in Bakersfield. We will be turning in written comments for the chapter. I am today speaking as an individual and not for the chapter itself. I appreciate the good work you've done on this plan. There are lots of good features of the plan. I do think, however, there are some things that could and should be strengthened. In particular, I'd like to sort of focus on something that I've long been involved in, sprawl, local and regional land use planning, and how you might make it easier for developers and cities and counties to mitigate the global warming impacts of their projects. As a result of CEQA litigation and the threat of CEQA litigation, the Sierra Club has agreements with 29 different development projects in the Bakersfield area, agreements on various land use impacts, air quality, farmland conversion, other things as well. And because of these agreements, developers call me and they want to talk to me before they come up with their, before they bring their projects in, so that we can deal with these things ahead of time. One of the things that I try to get them to mitigate is the global warming impact, greenhouse gas. Difficult to get them to do that. It's difficult to get them to agree to adequately mitigate their greenhouse gas emissions for several reasons. One, because it's costly for them to do that. Two, it's a new idea. New ideas are hard to are hard to push. Three, developers are really not very willing to do something unless it's uniform, unless everybody has to do it. Well, let me just talk about a couple of things that I try to get them to do and how we might proceed. I've been trying to get them to build solar photovoltaics into new construction as standard. What better place than California to generate electricity from the sun? Huh? It's difficult at this point to get them to do that because it's costly. PV is costly, and it takes some time to pay off. So it's difficult to get developers to agree to put solar photovoltaics on their houses. The solution is a good feed-in tariff system, like the proven German system. If California had a feed-in tariff system, a good one, solar photovoltaics would take off and soon become standard in new construction. Those of us on the greenhouse gas mitigation front lines would have a lot easier sell if feed-in tariffs were in effect. Your scoping plan, I think, should explicitly back feed-in tariffs. VMT has to be reduced. One way to do this is by adopting an effective indirect source rule for greenhouse gas emissions, similar to the Valley Air District's ISR. The fee should depend heavily on the impact. Several good reasons to adopt an ISR. Another thing that I try to get developers to do is to commit to green building and to better community design. If the developer had to pay an ISR fee for greenhouse gas emissions, and if the fee were reduced because of on-site green building and community design measures, that fee reduction would be a real incentive for them to build green and to reduce vehicle miles traveled. Of course, the existing criteria pollutant, ISR, incorporates successfully fee reductions for on-site mitigation. Technique is a proven one. So here's another good reason to do an ISR rule. Many other things that the draft scoping plan could be strengthened in the draft scoping plan. Public transportation projects promote efficiency and sustainability, reduction targets large enough to preclude business-as-usual sprawl should be incorporated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are looking at indirect source rules as one of the sort of things that are on the second tier, so we're familiar with those arguments. I don't know, Kevin, do you have anything on feed-in tariff?
I do know that to some degree both the Energy Commission and the Public Utilities Commission are talking about that as part of the overall, you know, how do we reach the targets for the renewables. I'm not sure of the details of the status, but we can follow up with them on that.
We have a question that came in from the web. This one, I'm not sure if we have staff in the room to speak to this, but if not, we can, we can reply directly. This came in from John Fuchs from Sempra. Question is, what is the mechanism that causes high GWP gases to be projected to increase so much by 2020? That is a definite growth area. I think part of it is that, you know, other areas are shrinking, so it gets larger by comparison. I don't know if there's anyone that... Could you speak to a mic, please?
In my understanding, the great growth projection for high GWP gases is because of the replacement of CFCs, which are non-Kyoto gases, with HFCs, which are Kyoto gases and thus in the inventory.
Okay, so... there's a transition towards the category that counts in our inventory from one that didn't count in the inventory. Interesting. Okay. Speaker number 13.
Good morning. Dr. Ed Moreno. I am the health officer for Fresno County. I also serve as the director of the public health department, and I am a pediatrician by training. I want to, first of all, thank all of you for being here and choosing Fresno as your location for your public hearing. And I'm very thankful that you have made such progress on the scoping plan. I'm delighted to know that ARB's first mandate is for protection of public health. And the scoping plan does include the evaluation of public health impacts and its benefits. So thank you. This is important for two reasons. First of all, global warming left unmitigated does have public health impacts. It's very important to recognize that. The result of rising heat and extreme heat days leads to morbidity and mortality, as we all know. And the decreased availability of water will, what I'm concerned about is it's going to lead to inability to produce the same amount of produce and crops that we have become accustomed to, and that would lead to food scarcity, which would then therefore lead to issues of food security as well. But AB 32 does, the plan does have solutions to reduce emissions, which have public health benefits, and you have provided the list in the plan. I thank you for that. The number of premature deaths that can be avoided, hospitalizations due to respiratory and cardiovascular diseases that would be avoided, and avoidance of lost work days because of the recommendations that are included in the plan. So thank you. The scoping plan also mentions several measures to implement, and one is the local government leadership. And there are several examples in the plan, and some of those are already happening. I just want to share a few with you briefly. In the area of land use, as a local health department, we are working with our elected officials, engineers, planners, and not-for-profit organizations to increase awareness about the benefits of community design and better land use on reducing respiratory and cardiovascular effects of our environment, but also reducing chronic disease. In the area of transportation, my staff participates on local and regional blueprint activities, again, for the interest of promoting public health through better land use. Specifically in transportation, I want to mention that your plan mentions that regional transportation is best applied to urban settings, but I want to let you know that here in the Central Valley, at least one large urban setting, but we look at regional transportation in terms of connectivity of our incorporated cities within the region. You also mentioned that we should be leading by example in the area of efficient fleets and water conservation. I agree with you. I think that local government, really state and local government, should be taking the lead in that area. And finally, the public health outreach. Again, I've been working with the universities here in the Central Valley, the Medical Society, American Lung Association, and other organizations to raise awareness about global warming. Now, these are important because the plan does point out that these lead to public health benefits. I want to point out that there are some public health co-benefits that aren't listed in the plan. These same activities do lead to, in addition, decreased vehicle miles, increased walking, increased nutrition, and leads to better health, decreased diabetes, decreased cerebrovascular disease, decreased incidence of cancer. So those are co-benefits that this plan can lead to that aren't recommended in the plan. I can't see them yet. So I leave you with respectfully with three recommendations and requests. One is that you involve state and local public health officials, health officers, and health officials, public health officials, State Department Public Health, for example, in the evaluation of public health impacts now and throughout the process. Two is that you recognize that AB 32 implementation will have additional public health co-benefits that should be identified in the plan. And three, that ARB and state work closely with local government, local health departments, and local agencies to implement Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, with an emphasis on land use, regional transportation, public outreach, and setting the example locally to maximize the public health benefits and co-benefits. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to do a time check here. How many speaker cards do we have outstanding? Do we know? I'm asking for my staff, I guess. How many did we hand out? We went up to 37, so 13, 20. Okay. I guess maybe we can tell it. What's underneath all this is we could break at lunch for an hour, or we could push on through. It's how many show of hands again in terms of people waiting to speak? probably about another hour's worth. Yeah, my sense would be to keep going, just hear people out, and then break after that. We're happy to stay as long as needed to listen to folks and talk to folks, but out of respect for everyone's time here, if it seems to me that if we could finish up by 12:30 or 12:45 or something like that, that maybe that's the way to go. So let's proceed on that basis in terms of folks planning their time. And Dennis, maybe he was going out to check. I do know there were some local physicians that were wanting to come in at 1. We can figure out what's going on with that along the way. Okay, Speaker 14, please.
Good morning. My name is Autumn Bernstein. Can you hear me? Good morning. My name is Autumn Bernstein. I'm the director of Climate Plan, which is a new network of leading public policy organizations here in California, including the Center for Clean Air Policy, American Farmland Trust, and Local Government Commission. Climate Plan's goal is to educate California policymakers.
I'll ask afterwards. I don't want to take away from your time.
Okay.
But I have a question.
Okay. about the connection between climate change and land use. That's our goal. So I will direct comments today towards the land use section of the scoping plan. I live in the Sierra, and prior to joining Climate Plan, I was a full-time advocate and community organizer on issues of land use planning, both here in the Valley and in the Sierra. So I learned a thing or two, including from Mr. Alanashita here. I learned that growth in the Valley and the Sierra is a study in contrast. On the one hand, you have a proposal to build a new town of 35,000 people in the foothills of Tulare County, several miles from the nearest town of Exeter and even further from any job center. Clearly, development like this will generate extremely high greenhouse gas emissions. On the other hand, we heard earlier about the city of Fresno that's developing an innovative plan for the city's southeast growth area. I looked at the city's website and did some calculations. There's going to be 120,000 people living in the southeast growth area when it's built out. And according to their analysis, those people will drive approximately 57% less each year compared to households in a conventional development in the Valley. That translates into a savings of 5 tons of CO2 per person every year. If you multiply that by 120,000, you get a saving of 600,000 tons of CO2 every year. Now, the southeast growth area is not going to be fully built out until 2050 or 2060, which illustrates the point that Keith Berkhold was making earlier, that land use is like the gift that keeps on giving. It doesn't happen overnight, but if you don't start early, you can't get to where you need to be. If we're going to get to the 2050 goal, we've got to start doing better land use planning right now. Things that are going to be on the ground in 2050 are being planned right now here in Fresno. Unfortunately, while we think there's a lot of good things about the scoping plan, it's not enough to encourage plans like the Southeast Growth Area and discourage plans like the new town in Yokel Valley. The reduction goal of 2 million metric tons is far too low to be meaningful. The Sacramento region alone has set a goal of 750,000 tons by 2020, which means that despite being 6% of the state's population, they will achieve nearly 40% of the state's reductions without any direction or incentives from CARB whatsoever. Clearly, we can do better, and we need to do better. Climate Plan is currently working with land use and climate researchers to develop a new target for what we believe can be achieved by 2020, and we look forward to sharing the results of that analysis with you. We also think that there's additional tools such as the indirect source rule, congestion pricing, that if adopted would also increase the ability of local governments to achieve that target. Not only would they help us reduce VMT, but they would also provide a needed source of revenue for local governments to implement things like transit infill incentives. Local governments don't have a lot of money to achieve ambitious mandates, but if they're given tools that both allow them to achieve the mandate and create a revenue stream, that would go a long way towards making sure these reductions happen. We're also concerned about the plan's failure to address transit. Building more compact, walkable communities simply does not work without transit. You can't have TOD without the T. So we believe the plan should ensure that California invests transportation infrastructure dollars in a manner that which encourages better land use patterns. Lastly, as a Sierran, I have to ask what you want to do about counties that are not part of a metropolitan planning organization. The plan talks about regional targets but doesn't clarify what a region is. The San Joaquin Valley, the Sierra, most of the counties here are not part of an MPO, but they're some of the fastest growing places in the state. So there needs to be a clear strategy for dealing with counties that are not part of an MPO. And I think that county by county plans are not going to work because that's kind of the way things happen already. Regional planning is critically important, and we need to make sure that it works works for all parts of California, not just the MPOs. How the Valley and Sierra Grove will have a profound impact on California's success in achieving the mandate of AB 32. On behalf of Climate Plan, I urge CARB to take action now to make sure that it's a success. Thank you.
Thank you. Just my question was that your organization, how new is this? Or?
Climate Plan was actually formed around the AB 32 scoping plan process.
Okay.
So it's been since February 2007, and I've been on board for about 4 months as the first staff person.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Because we've dealt with the folks individually, but I believe this is the first interaction I've seen from them. So good. Thank you. Welcome. And then, Jeff, on the issue of the mountain counties or, you know, sort of, could you speak a little bit to what we're recommending and do we have in place something for the non-MPO or is that sort of second tier and we're focusing on the MPOs?
That's something that that we will need to work out. We realize that the five major regions in the state, if you include San Joaquin as a one region, includes 90% of the population and about 85% of the vehicle miles traveled right now. That doesn't mean the other areas are not important. It's just that there has been discussion about doing it on a tiered basis and first working with the major regions in the state for targets and then going the second tier as we learn and get a coalition of those the smaller areas. So thanks for your comment on that.
Thank you. Speaker number 15, please.
May I speak after everyone's done instead of now?
That's fine. Thanks. Unless you get in a war with someone else that wants to be last. Number 16. Just and if I forget, sir, feel free to wave your hand. All right, 16.
Good morning. I'm Mark Height, representing CEV, the California Council on Environmental and Economic Balance. We're just going to make kind of 4 points. The first one is more of a kind of a technical thing. We kind of hoped that the scoping plan would have a glossary of terms, not to make targets for people to shoot at, but there's some terminology that's used throughout the plan, like compliance obligation and additionality that I think we all kind of conceptually know what's meant, but it would be helpful if we knew specifically what CARB meant by it. We feel that the plan needs to develop indicators to measure the program's impact on the overall economy as well as greenhouse gas reductions. This is kind of the off-ramp concept where you have certain indicators that you monitor, like price of gasoline, number of people in the queue for waiting permit approvals for AB 32 compliance projects, how long that queue's getting, just certain things so you can kind of make program adjustments along the way. The next point was mentioned earlier by some folks that we think that you need to recognize that under the AB 32 process, the state should have some sort of a responsibility to facilitate permit approvals, some sort of CEQA streamlining, particularly for if refineries need to do things. There are going to be different industries that have to do certain sort of building projects, just for scrubbers, whatever they need, and rather than get caught up in some sort of local permit tangle that could go on for years and years, which would kind of impede the progress of the AB 32 program. And the last point is that we feel that the reductions that are assigned to the different sectors, it's very important that they be as proportional as possible. And we will be supplying a few additional points, but more detail in writing later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Regarding a glossary, we do have one in the appendix that's going to be coming out, although, as I recall, it doesn't include the two specific items that you mentioned. So that's maybe half a loaf. Thank you. Speaker number 17, please.
Good Yeah, my name is Cal Sisto. I'm a private consulting meteorologist in Visalia. And I just have a very brief comment. I have a background in outreach and in a history of broadcasting in my career to schools, various educational and community institutions. And something was mentioned in passing about the importance of education to the community and especially reaching to our children to make the goals of AB 32 a reality over a period of time. And I just want to emphasize how important that is to be a part of the planning process, that as this comes together, that that CARB work with educators, with the state educational institutions, and try to reach down to local authorities, too, so that the curriculum can contain information that will help bring this part of the whole plan along, that future generations definitely need to be involved. And we get very caught up in all the discussions of the technicalities of what we want to do and stuck in the red tape of the bureaucracy, but we need to make sure that the message gets to the people who are really going to make it happen over a period of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Sharon Anderson, who is here, is head of the outreach for AB 32 specifically, and then she coordinates. We've got, at the ARB level, we've got a communications office, et cetera, and, you know, we're working hard to try and even internally have a consistent message, but part of that is also working with schools. Sharon, I don't know if you had anything to add at this point, or...
And actually, I think if you've seen in the plan, there actually is state law that was passed that requires K through 12 to incorporate climate change into the educational curriculum, and we're working with the folks that are working on that program to get that incorporated into the curriculum statewide.
Thank you. Speaker number 18.
Good morning. Lottie Askill, Sustainable Conservation. Sustainable Conservation is an environmental organization that works with the ag sector primarily to develop win-win solutions to some of the challenges that ag faces. I want to congratulate ARB on the scoping plan. It's a really well thought out and balanced approach, we think. One aspect of the plan we think needs some strengthening is that aspect of regulatory coordination, and we hope that by the final draft in October, that aspect is strengthened into some type of a formal role that recognizes that greenhouse gases do sometimes are at odds with other types of emissions. In the case of digesters, for example, the plan recommends that most of the reductions in the ag sector are going to come from digesters. Digesters are currently stalled because of much higher NOx emission requirements. Now, NOx emission requirements at 9 parts per million really beyond the best control available technologies right now. So that's a real challenge. The San Joaquin Valley has serious air problems, and the issue is how we transition new projects that run into some of these institutional barriers. And we're hoping that some form of coordination can help negotiate those challenges. People who have invested in digesters, there's an example of one who's, you know, invested over $3 million and now at jeopardy because of the emission requirements. So individual project developers cannot afford to come up against these institutional barriers. We need some formalized approach to help them overcome that. Beyond the situation with engines, it may next be fuel cells or gasification projects that are coming down the pike. It may not be NOx emissions, but it may be some other type of emission that causes serious problems for developers. So we hope that that is taken into consideration.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. Number 19, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning and thank you. I am Gerald Vinard. I am one of several members of the Sierra Club here in the audience today. I'm here specifically on behalf of the statewide arm of the Sierra Club, Sierra Club, California. We would like to begin by thanking and commending the California Air Resources Board and the members of its staff for the many hours of hard work you have invested in the plan. We think you have done an excellent job. We do have a few suggestions. We are particularly pleased about the inclusion of the 33% standard for renewable energy. However, there are some things that could be done to advance AB 32's clean energy vision. First, we would like to suggest the use of community choice aggregation, which we hope will allow cities to pool their buying power to purchase clean energy. Second, and this supports remarks by several other speakers, we believe that feed-in tariffs to require utility companies to pay a fair price for renewable energy should be adopted. We urge CARB to do everything it can to reduce the greenhouse gases generated by our transportation system, and particularly by automobiles. CARB should include stronger measures to reform land use planning in ways that will reduce vehicle miles traveled. CARB should also search for ways to increase the number of zero emission vehicles on the road from the fewer than 8,000 we understand are on the road today. We know that offsets are being considered. We support the views that have been expressed this morning to the effect that any offsets should be kept to a minimum, and we agree that they should be subjected to rigorous criteria. We are pleased about the proposed limit of 10%, but suggest a limit of 5% or less would be better. We are pleased to see that the plan proposes that a large majority of the required reduction in emissions and greenhouse gases will come from performance standards that directly reduce emissions, with only 21% proposed for the cap and trade program. We would like to see that percentage reduced, if at all possible. Sierra Club California has submitted written comments that are much more lengthy than I'm able to present this morning. I'd like to invite you to read them. Once again, I'd like to thank you for your time and your attention this morning.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Speaker number 20, please.
Good morning. My name is John Hunhet, and I live in Fresno County. I am the sprawl chair of the Sierra Club's Tehipity chapter, and I represent members in Fresno, Madera, and Merced counties. First, my thanks to CARB staff for developing a visionary AB 32 draft scoping plan. However, we believe that better measures to promote smarter land use and more efficient transportation planning and projects in major urban areas, such as Fresno, could provide greater greenhouse gas reductions by 2020 and beyond. ARB must not only encourage but require transit-oriented development, walkable and bikeable communities, and mixed land uses that are integrated into regional transportation plans, which will reduce the total number of vehicle miles traveled by Californians. Tools such as congestion pricing and indirect source rules would strengthen this plan. CARB has the authority to do this. CARB should also adopt performance metrics and greenhouse gas performance standards that will guide communities in making actual measurable reductions in greenhouse gases. Local, regional, and state authorities must be able to demonstrate that they are reducing vehicle miles traveled. We need to immediately fast-track regional mass transit systems, including bus rapid transit. Transit systems should also be held to strict performance-based standards. Additionally, CARB should require the Building Standards Commission to adopt strong green building standards that include a land use component. The greenest building in the world is not sustainable if it is far from its workers' homes. The regional blueprint planning process is a big step in the right direction, and CARB should require that general plans, transportation planning, and projects meet regional greenhouse gas targets. With respect to goods movement, CARB should work with state transportation agencies to plan commercially viable electric rail systems to replace diesel trucks and trains. This would reduce congestion on California's highways and lower total vehicle emissions. We are disappointed with CARB's low expectations for agriculture. This plan only mentions one potential ton reduction from methane capture at large dairies. CARB needs to quickly determine how to reduce emissions from the use of nitrogen fertilizers and from farm equipment. Agriculture should also be required to reduce its water use, since agriculture accounts for more than 75% of the state's total water use. Support for urban agriculture should be considered, especially community gardens for apartment dwellers. Thank you for developing a visionary draft plan. We endorse the Sierra Club California's written comments and suggest that you refer to them for more information. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a comment and a question, I guess, while you're there. The comment is on the nitrogen fertilizer issue anyway. We're looking at that. The thinking was that there was more research needed before you could really get very specific about the measurement issues. I mean, there were just a lot of issues associated with it. But it is something that's recognized in what we're doing as an area where there's some potential. But we just didn't feel it was ripe enough, really, to get much more specific. But it is specifically part of what we're doing. And I guess my question, and maybe it's unfair to pose this to you, but it kind of popped into my mind when you were talking. You know, we're hearing a fair amount here about the land use angle and, you know, very aggressive work underway for that southeast growth area and just all the things that are happening. I mean, is there a consensus at the local and regional level here to move forward aggressively in this area, or are we only hearing from sort of like half of the people? If I took a poll with everybody, you know, I'm just kind of curious because listening to this, it sounds... You know, it sounds, and particularly in light of the planning document, which presumably represents some sort of public process. So, I mean, you know, this sounds like there's a lot of, a lot of support for these notions, which have been pretty difficult to get at. And I was just curious as to sort of, you know, your thoughts on the degree of consensus that exists.
My opinion is the Southeast Growth Area Plan is an excellent plan. It will be dovetailed in with the blueprint process, including the Metro Rural Loop. That's a transportation plan. And I think there's a lot of local support. It's new. It's just being shared with the community. But so far, there's a lot of enthusiasm for it. And I think going forward, it has tremendous potential. It needs to be replicated throughout the state. I realize that there's other communities and regions that are doing similar plans. Hopefully these plans that are not mandatory will get some teeth, and I think your organization has the ability to make sure that they are implemented throughout the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Speaker number 21, please. 22.
I was going to say good morning, but it's almost good afternoon. My name is Randy Gann. I'm the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Fresno Madera Tulare Kings Central Labor Council. We are the AFL-CIO grassroots entity in our community of Fresno Madera Tulare and Kings counties. I'm here today because we represent at least the working interests of approximately 65,000 members in that region. We are very interested in the work of the Air Resources Board and the scoping plan, and we are advocating to our people that they, too, become very interested and get involved in this process. So we support the goals of AB 32 and appreciate the hard work of the Air Resources Board and staff. We have a couple of points we want to make in that regard. All of this is going to cost a lot of money, and you see in the plan and here today, people understand that there will be a cost, and there's a great opportunity to invest in California. So our first point is to invest in California's infrastructure and innovation. Whatever system is crafted to lower the greenhouse gas emissions, all the revenues generated should be closely managed by the public for the public good. Along with the investment, workforce investments needed, regulations should promote investment in the California economy, not other states. Revenues will be needed for financing innovation and adoption of new technologies that can lead to permanent reductions in the emissions in California. This includes retooling industry, research and development of the new technology, rebuilding California's manufacturing base, and upgrading our infrastructure. Funds should be invested in public transit, denser urban development, building retrofits. Since whatever market mechanisms include cap or auction, excuse me, or fees, there should be no windfall profits for producers. Since low-income consumers will be the hardest hit by increased energy prices, transition help and public investment in housing energy efficiencies are also critical. Second point, to invest in the California workforce. For example, community colleges, workforce investment boards, and union apprenticeship programs are critical training assets that need scaling up. It is also essential that we reinvigorate career technical education in California for the next generation of workers who will build our green future. Third item, prevent jobs from leaving the state. The Air Resources Board can prevent this leakage by implementing effective policies to ensure that out-of-state producers have to play on the same playing field as in-state producers. Adopt policies that direct investment in California, not other places. Any offsets must be in-state offsets that would drive economic development in California by pushing for technological solutions related to permanent reductions at home. And then finally, assist workers in their transition to a greener California economy modeled on the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Trade Assessment Assistance Program. Thank you so much.
Could you give, what was the name of that last program again? Federal Trade.
Yeah, the Federal Trade Adjustment Assistance Program.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Number 23, please.
Good morning. My name is John Friedrich. I'm speaking today as a father of a beautiful two-year-old daughter, Rosie, and I just want to thank you for the taking his first concrete steps to leave a healthy planet behind for all of our children. There's certainly a lot at stake, and proud to be in a state that's taking the first steps to deal with this big problem. I also want to focus on the land use component and the need to greatly strengthen it in the plan. There's a clear and established linkage between land use patterns and vehicle miles traveled, and therefore emissions of greenhouse gases. In a letter written to Tulare County in response to their draft general plan, the Office of the California Attorney General said, "Unless we depart from the business-as-usual paradigm and embrace the new principles of smart growth, we risk pushing the environment past the, quote, tipping point into cataclysmic climate change. The decisions the county makes today can help move California into a new era of development and sustainable growth, consistent with the state's goals to a lower carbon future." Senate Bill 375, introduced by Senator Steinberg and working its way through the legislature, states, "It is necessary to achieve significant greenhouse gas reductions from changed land use patterns and improve transportation to meet AB 32 standards. Transportation and CEQA incentives are needed for greater housing choices, shorter commutes, reduced climate emissions, less air pollution, less fossil fuel consumption, and greater conservation of farmlands and habitat." Unfortunately, the draft scoping plan has provided a meager reduction target for land use and development. As was mentioned by previous speakers, or at least one previous speaker, the Sacramento Land Use Plan proposes to reduce global warming pollution by 750,000 metric tons by 2030, which is more than one-third of the draft scoping plan target for the entire state. Clearly, we can do better than that. The scoping plan should greatly increase the reduction target associated with land use and development. The plan should contain requirements for local governments to meet mandatory enforced greenhouse gas reduction targets in the general plans and when considering specific large development proposals. Transportation and other funding should be provided to local governments that implement true smart growth solutions as a carrot and as a benefit. In addition, as others have mentioned, the scoping plan should implement an indirect source rule for greenhouse gas emissions, similar to the rule successfully adopted by the San Joaquin Air District for NOx in particulate matter. This rule provides disincentives for sprawling growth, makes it more costly, and indirectly benefits for lower impact compact developments, such as mentioned here, the Southeast Growth Area proposed in Fresno, which is an example of a project that should be rewarded for taking steps towards efficiency and sustainability. And finally, I definitely support the carbon fees as a means to bring about the shift to a lower carbon future. If we make it more expensive to pollute the planet, surely we'll start shifting in mass to more sustainable, lower footprint solutions, and I think that's an important step to take. So I want to thank you for considering these comments, and again, there's a lot at stake for all of us and for future generations. I just encourage you to take the steps necessary, even the controversial ones, to strengthen the plan and take the address the things that really do cause the problems and provide solutions in the areas where people are doing the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, time check in, and Dennis, I think you might have been out of the room when I was saying earlier, in light of the number of folks, what we're planning to do is just push through and finish up the room. That might take us till about one, but just wanted to let you know for purposes of your own planning. Is Jerry still around, or he might? Yeah. We have another request here in terms of some of the – another number. Great. Number 24, please. And there may be – some of these other ones, people may be gone. Are you – number 25? Well, we'll zoom through here. 26?
Thank you. Thank you for coming to Fresno. I represent a couple different hats here. One is the I'm on the San Joaquin Air Pollution Control District. I grew up in the valley in an agricultural family, and then I also am a physician taking care of some of the people in the valley. In regards to my hat as with the Air Pollution Control District, I would encourage you to talk quickly to the air pollution control officers and coordinate an effort, and we don't end up with some kind of patchwork effort going on. The air pollution control districts obviously will be a resource for education, monitoring, and enforcement of this plan, and unless you talk to them quickly, I think they'll move ahead. There may be some duplication and loss of resources. My concern is that here in our valley, the Air Pollution Control District is moving ahead without coordination with you all, and that some of the resources that we would direct to our primary cause of reducing air pollution will be lost because there's not this coordinated effort. And I would also encourage quickly funding for this effort to the local air pollution control districts. In regards to agriculture, I wonder if you are looking into what's changing in the San Joaquin Valley as far as kind of the reforestation of the San Joaquin Valley. The crop inventory here has changed dramatically over the last 30 years. There's more permanent crops. There's hundreds of thousands of acres of almonds, pistachios, other types of trees going in every year. I wonder if that's looked into as far as, you know, carbon credits for the valley. One of the problems we have is to take care of our diesel pumps on farms. There's a program which has funding for that, which is soon going to be running out, and without adequate funds for that, we won't be able to accomplish some of the goals. And I wonder if the carbon credits which are occurring on farms can be somewhat directed towards that. In regards to my physician comments, I was in the Sacramento presentation, I was especially pleased to see the health benefits. But I kind of, when I was looking at those, I wonder if they're real. And the reason why I say that is if you look on page 59 of the plan, there's an estimated reduction of emissions. And if I'm reading that right, it says that the NOx emissions throughout the state are going to be reduced by 50 tons per year, and the PM2.5 is going to be reduced by 10 tons per day. I mean, and that just doesn't translate into the type of, from what I know of this process so far, it doesn't translate into the type of general health benefits that you are predicting. Here in the San Joaquin Valley, I mean, if we reduce that by that much, it may not translate into the 324 lives saved. And just wondering if that's an overestimate. And the estimation process, I would encourage you to look at, refine it into looking at air basins rather than spreading that emissions reduction throughout the whole state, because it's kind of meaningless unless you put it right into the air basins where you can collect the data. Another thing in regards to physicians can be a tremendous resource for education, and I would encourage you to talk to the CMA, the California Medical Association, and local medical societies to participate in your educational process for the country or for the state. And that's all my comments, but I wanted to address the one question you asked about was there uniform agreement in the IRS, the indirect source rule here in Fresno. When that was passed, I think some of the Sierra Club was there. I was there in 2006. It was not an easy thing to do. There was a lot of disagreement, but it was passed. I think the things that you're hearing about in Southeast Fresno probably couldn't happen unless that was passed. I would strongly encourage you to get together with the local district to look at that plan. I think it would be a great template for the whole state. And it's we reviewed the results of that in our last meeting, and it's had a tremendous impact in reducing some of the emissions that we're concerned about. Thank you.
Thank you. A couple things. We are talking to CAPCOA early and often. There are a lot of issues certainly associated with that, but this issue of the need to coordinate the activities at the district level with what's happening at the state level, we certainly recognize the importance of that, and we've had discussions at the APCO level with our executive officer and then various staff groups. So we're trying to make that coordination, and we recognize the importance. The reforestation question with respect to the change in crop patterns, I can't really speak to that, you know, to what extent that shows up in our inventory or our planning, but it's a interesting issue. Yeah, please.
We've actually had a lot of interest in terms of, especially in terms of permanent crops and the carbon sequestration that's achieved in those. Currently, we don't have the same type of quantification protocols for quantifying the amount of carbon stored in those crops, and so that would kind of be the first step towards it, using addressing the carbon storage in permanent crops. So that's something that we can look at in the future. But it is not addressed in the current plan.
And then two things that Edie perhaps could address wearing two different hats. I mean, the first one was sounded like Moyer funding or funding for diesel pumps, which was her old job. And then the second one has to do with the quantification of the health benefits, which relates to her new job.
Okay, on the incentives for diesel pumps and conversion, there's been actually, as you know, thousands of diesel agricultural pumps that have been converted either to cleaner diesel engines or to electric as part of the Moyer program, as well as funding through USDA has also contributed to that. Part of the reason that funding is going to run out is because there's actually laws that are going to require, you know, the Valley has a rule, as well as there is also a state rule that's requiring growers to convert their pumps. Excuse me. And so as we don't provide incentive money if it's a regulatory requirement. And so I think that's part of the reason that the funding is starting to run out for those kinds of projects. There will, I think, continue to be opportunities for electrification projects to the extent that folks want to go from diesel to electrification, because that's sort of over, above, and beyond any regulatory requirement. And in addition to state money, there's been interest from some folks that are interested in these voluntary offset programs. There have been some interest in providing funding to provide for electrification of diesel agricultural pumps. So I think that some programs will continue, but they probably won't be as widespread out into the future. And then the issue about the public health benefits and the calculations that we've done, we actually tried to be relatively conservative when we did those numbers. You're right, they're statewide, and it's very, very hard to look at public health on a statewide basis because you're trying to make assumptions on this top-down basis, and we recognize we need to really get down, you really need to get down to a local area, and that's where it becomes really difficult in a program like this, not knowing exactly what's going to happen in every place. So we are going to try to take a look at localized impacts. We are going to try to take a look at if we did some regional, can we do some regional work and assign these reductions to different areas of the state and what might happen with air quality modeling, or if we can just look at emissions. So we are trying to take to the next level, and that's what we're hopefully going to see in the evaluation supplement that comes out later this summer.
Thank you. Speaker 27.
Good afternoon. I'm Derek Walker, Director of the California Climate Initiative with Environmental Defense Fund. We have over 100,000 members in the state of California. And as many of you know, we were also a co-sponsor of the Global Warming Solutions Act, AB 32. This is a great step forward, this plan we're discussing today. Lots of great stuff in here, lots to like. Probably also, as you're finding out, lots to take aim at, unfortunately. As Kevin said earlier, you know, I'm sure many people are aware, we're really at a pivotal point in where the national and international discussions about climate change are going. And California's work in this area is going to have an amazing and important impact on our ability as a global community to coalesce around a new agreement on climate change. So this plan really takes all the tools in the toolkit, whether they're just in the options to consider or whether they've already been included as required measures. You really get at a lot of different sectors and a lot of different business practices that we know we need to transform in order to be in line with AB 32's goals. We need to continue to look for opportunities, as many people have said today, for co-benefits. Those are air quality co-benefits, economic co-benefits, including job growth. I know a lot of people would like to see additional measures for training and retraining for green jobs. I think that's an important down the road, but not that far down the road, consideration that you all need to look at. And I did come here today mainly to amplify what a lot of other people are saying about transportation and land use. We're in a part of the state that's, as you know, overburdened by air quality concerns and other types of pollution that result directly from poor land use and transportation decisions that have really been endemic for many, many years. The Environmental Defense Fund came out last week with a report that was done by Dr. Lawrence Frank at the University of British Columbia, and that reports on the indirect source rule, and I'll provide copies to CARB staff. And what this report shows is really what many people already know, which is the profound connection between transportation and land use planning and greenhouse gas emissions, but also the emissions of other types of pollutants. And right now, the indirect source rule is mentioned in the plan as a optional, or should say a measure under consideration. We would like to see the final version of the plan make a request of all air air boards, local air boards, to implement the indirect source rule by January 1st, 2012. We think that's a vital measure. As many people have said, the decisions that we're making now are going to put us on the path that we need to be on, or not put us on the path that we need to be on for 2050. A couple more things I wanted to mention. One is pay-as-you-drive insurance. That's a measure that's under development right now, at least in the beginning stages, by the Commissioner of Insurance. Environmental Defense Fund also has a bill in the legislature on that, but it would send a very strong signal to not only the supportive insurance companies, which most of the large insurance companies are supportive, but it would also send an important signal about consumer choice and CARB's interest in looking for measures that offer consumers the opportunity to save money as well as expand their choices, which is, I think, an important part of keeping the public interested in this. And the final thing I wanted to say is that, you know, there's a legacy of funding projects that are not beneficial for greenhouse gas emissions, and I think everyone knows that. And now that we have AB 32 on the books, I think we have a tremendous opportunity to link transportation, especially transportation funding, with projects that are beneficial to the environment. My final point is on the last individual's comment or question about reforestation. The California Climate Action Registry just came out with a RFP last week for basically anybody who has ideas on new protocols that need to be put out, new kinds of accounting that haven't been done yet. So I would encourage anybody here who has the type of project they think is underrepresented to participate in that RFP process.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Need to do another time check. I've been informed by the webcast contractor that we're having some overload problems, I guess, and they need a little bit of time to try and sort this through. How many people in the audience here still wish to speak? 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. Let's take a 30-minute break. I'd be interested in what people think. I mean, he needs some time. Well, no, I need to honor the. I'm sorry? So you think 10 minutes is good? Okay, then let's. We need to honor the webcast because there's a lot of outside interest on these things, and people do follow in. So I apologize to those of you in the room, but let's come back here at 12:30. And we will resume at that time. And apologize for the inconvenience. Thank you very much. looks like we may have lost some people here in the transition. Well, let's go ahead and get underway. For those of you following along on the webcast, sounds like there have been some difficulties. I apologize for that. I hope that's all working. If it's not and you're not hearing me, then we're out of luck. But because we have got a number of people physically here in Fresno waiting to speak, we're going to go ahead and move forward. Number 28. Number 29. Number 30. Well, sounds like, looks like people voted with their feet. 31? Good. I'm sorry, which were you, ma'am?
Huh?
What number?
29.
Go for it.
29.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. My name is Daniela Simunovic, and I work with the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment based in Delano, California. I want to welcome you to the San Joaquin Valley and to the place in the state and in the nation with the dirtiest air. So, climate change and air pollution are very significant because they have a very significant disproportionate impact on low-income communities of color, not just globally, but also here locally in the San Joaquin Valley. And so my comments are really going to be directed about the San Joaquin Valley and how we would like to see this plan strengthened to have more benefits for residents here in the valley, in particular environmental justice communities, low-income communities of color. The San Joaquin Valley has a number, a multitude of issues. We have highest rates of poverty, unemployment, dirtiest air, and there's a lot of challenges here in the valley, and there's a lot of AB 32 takes on more importance here and the implementation. So this plan is a start, but in order for it to be a plan that we can fully embrace and can fully have benefits for environmental justice communities, I'm going to make some suggestions to you all how you can make it stronger for us. One is the air pollution and greenhouse gas co-benefits that a lot of people have discussed already. It's very significant for us that any measure to reduce greenhouse gases is tied to air pollution reductions, and we think that there is much more room in this plan for you guys to make more significant reductions in NOx and PM 2.5 and in greenhouse gases. The San Joaquin Valley's economy is really tied to, I'll talk about that later. agriculture. I've noted that, you know, agriculture is 6% of the greenhouse gas emissions problem in your diagram, but yet none of the regulations that you're proposing here, measures you're proposing on agriculture are required, and I'm not understanding why. That doesn't make sense to me. That seems irresponsible policy. So I think that we would like to see those be required regulations, and we'd like to see more measures there. Our organization has joined the California Environmental Justice Movement and is taking a stance against any carbon trading and offset programs, and so we are very concerned about their inclusion in the scoping plan. You know, we're concerned because we've seen what happened with the environmental, the European Union's trading scheme that failed to deliver the reductions that it had promised. We think it's an undemocratic system, and again, trading can really create create and worsen existing hotspots for air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. And since that's already a concern here in the valley, we're concerned that these offsets in your plan may lead to a displacement of more pollution in the San Joaquin Valley, which is already facing an overload of the burdens. In relation to the low carbon fuel standard, we would like to see CARB take a stronger stance there, in particular in relation to corn-based ethanol. The science that's come out in terms of its carbon footprint from the well to your car is pretty high, and in addition to that, in the San Joaquin Valley is really being inundated right now by proposals for corn-based ethanol plants in the valley, and so we would like to see CARB take a strong stance on that because it's going to lead to a huge, could potentially lead to a huge NOx increase and greenhouse gas increase in the valley. So we need CARB to take a stronger stance so local governments can have a more of a guidance. In terms of energy efficiency, we agree that that's important, but that we want to make sure that any programs that you guys are undertaking are accessible to low-income communities of color, low-income residents that are already failing, I mean, are struggling to deal, especially in this economy. We agree that you, I think it is consensus in a lot of us here that we need stronger direction from the state to local governments in terms of land use planning. We're the fastest growing region in the state. There's no, as we are now, there are large, you know, there's medium growth size cities that are far outside of our urban centers. Like, I'll give an example of in Kern County, there's a city of Wasco, which is a city of 15,000 people, which is about 20 minutes or 30 minutes from Bakersfield. The majority of people from Wasco commute to Bakersfield. There's no public transit. There's not sufficient transit to get people there to make it work. And so looking to improve transit corridors like that. In addition, talking, going back to the economy, the San Joaquin Valley's economy right now is based on agriculture, a lot of it, with greenhouse. If the greenhouse gas and the temperatures keep on rising, our agricultural economy is in danger, so we need to get the reductions to save ag. We also, you know, you talk a lot about promoting the green economy and investment, and we would like to see some measures to ensure that that isn't just to LA and the Bay, but that the San Joaquin Valley seeks that there's some targeted benefit here, especially given that we're the Appalachians of the West with our unemployment and our poverty rates. We need to see investment driven here. And that's it. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, that was 29. I'll circle back to 28. Going once. Okay, then number 30 was just about ready to go, I believe. We'd lose number 30? Oh, 31. That's right. 31. Thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Ishida. I am a member of the Board of Supervisors of Tulare County. I'm a third-generation farmer on the east side of Tulare County. My family's been farming there for 100 years. The one thing I've learned real early in my life, there are three necessities to life. The first one's water, the second one is food, and the third one's shelter. AB 32 has a direct impact on all three of those. So I deal a lot as an elected official with the unintended consequences of regulations that were passed before that have been more or less changed from the intent of the original legislation. So I want you to be very cautious how you approach your regulations and your criteria under AB 32, because I see this as probably one of the biggest gifts you could give to the litigating segment of our California economy. As a farmer, without nitrogen, you do not have food and fiber. So I hope that you study that very carefully before you make any recommendations. I think one of the things in government, you ask about how we can improve building green. If you would remove prevailing wages from government projects, we could build the greenest buildings that were known to modern science. When we have to spend 30 to 40% of a building cost on prevailing wages, it really ties our hands for us to build very efficient buildings. We are motivated to build efficient buildings because of the cost of energy. I think that's something everybody's motivated to do, even in the private sector. But prevailing wages is a real stumbling block for local government. Sequester carbon. You know, we're all here, we're all breathing the smoke. If we don't get control of our timberland, I'm not sure anything you can do in AB 32 is really going to make that much of a difference. We need to go back and control our timberland and plan harvesting the timber. The only way you sequester timber in the long run is make houses or make buildings out of them, compared to letting all these fires burn up the timberland that we have and our sequestered carbon. Goods movement. Tulare County put an offer in on a railroad line last month. Because on the east side of the San Joaquin Valley, there's a railroad company called Rail America that filed for an abandonment of a very strategic piece of this track from basically South Tulare County all the way to Sacramento. If we had lost that south connection, we would have lost probably the whole viability of an east side rail line. And as more and more goods We'll need to go by rail because it's more efficient and it's cleaner. And our major carriers on the main truck lines, Union Pacific and BSNF, are not providing services for a lot of our customers because they do not have the car count that makes them reach the highest profit potential. So I would look to the Air Board to help us save the East Side Rail Corridor so we can have goods movement and probably passenger movement. But overall, I just want to say the land use, you can't treat every county or municipality with the same standards. There are more people in the city of Fresno, in the city limits, than we have in our whole county. And there are a lot of other counties that have different land use issues than the urban counties have. One of the easiest ways to save vehicle miles traveled is find a mechanism to where you bring the jobs to where there are affordable housing, or you create affordable housing where the jobs are. There are over 50,000 commuters every day from Stanislaus County driving over 80 miles a day to commute to work. That affects air quality in the whole San Joaquin Valley. So vehicle miles, I believe, are very easy to solve. You put the jobs where the houses are, or you put the houses where the jobs are. And as an elected official in charge of land use, I think that we're not willing to give up that responsibility. So thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your patience. Had I known we had a local elected official, we would have called you sooner. I think we didn't communicate on that. But right. But, again, thank you very much for all of your comments. Number 32.
Good afternoon. I wanted to thank the ARB staff for all the work that's been put into developing this scoping plan. My name is Mark Stout, and I'm the Director of Renewable Technology Planning with Clean Tech America. We're a utility-scale renewable projects developer. There's an office here in Fresno. We're headquarters in San Francisco. And so I'm down here. We're working on our first two announced projects are solar farms. One's for PG&E. It's a 5-megawatt farm that'll be online, depending on what Congress does, 2009-2010. And also we have a three-year project announced with Kings River Conservation District for an 80-megawatt solar farm also here in the central San Joaquin Valley. And so what I really wanted to focus on today was the economic benefits of the 33% renewables portfolio standard that's in the scoping plan because, you know, a lot of people say, well, boy, isn't it going to be expensive to buy all those renewables and, you know, that kind of discussion is going on. And I think that many people have found that not only are renewables going to become less expensive than conventional generation right now, but also we're seeing that the secondary benefits of job creation and tax base and whatnot are actually exceed the initial outlay early on through the RPS compliance. So I did some numbers looking at California's 2006 power consumption, and I didn't look at the Department of Finance projections for what the population is expected to be in 2020. But if you just look at the 2006 power consumption numbers in the state and apply a 33% RPS standard, and then I'm just going to look at solar power because I understand the job creation numbers on that a lot better than other technologies. If you just look at solar power and you assume it's capturing a fifth of the RPS standard, so of the, let's see, of the 86,000 gigawatt hours that would be required from renewables under the RPS, if 20% of those came from solar, that means, bottom line, you need 9 billion watts of solar power. That's several times bigger than the entire California Solar Initiative, and that's just to fulfill the RPS requirements. UC Berkeley study showed that for every gigawatt of solar power, you would get 13,000 job years of local construction and maintenance jobs and 20,000 job years of manufacturing jobs. which is particularly important since we have several leading-edge manufacturers located here in California now. People, you know, people like NanoSolar, Applied Materials is going whole hog into solar. They really stand to benefit on the manufacturing, and the local communities benefit on the construction and maintenance. And so for this 33% RPS requirement, that boils down to about 117,000 job years for local construction and maintenance, and 180,000 job years for the manufacturing sector. And that's just to fulfill the one-fifth capture that solar got out of the entire RPS 33% pie. So you can multiply those numbers out much bigger to look at the entire RPS. To give you an idea, in Germany right now we have 500,000 people are in the renewable energy sector. It's a lot more than in California, but that shows the kind of potential for a country that's got the latitude of the Aleutian Islands and is the biggest solar power project developer in the world, the biggest market. They have 500,000 people in renewables. We can do that in California. The 33% RPS is the way to get there. And finally, just want to mention on the – I noticed that the draft plan addressed the limited offsets or trying to do some kind of verification of what's going on with emissions offsets. And from the renewable power project developer's perspective, we would like to see that it be crafted in a way that so the projects happen here. They don't fly off to, you know, forestation projects that are tough to verify, all that kind of thing. So I'm not going to pick a number, but I appreciate that the draft plan is looking at that issue. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We have a physician that was invited by the American Lung Association who's apparently on a pretty short time leash, so I'd like to go ahead and provide an opportunity for him to speak now. Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity. I'm Don Gady. I practice internal medicine and vascular medicine here in Fresno, and a member of the Fresno Madera Medical Society Air Quality Commission. You know, a funny thing happened to me. I wasn't sure if I was going to come here and speak today, but a funny thing happened on Thursday to my weekly tennis league match. It got canceled. A combination of temperatures of 112 and AQI that was almost in the purple range canceled that whole thing. And that's when I knew I had to come here and talk to you about the effects of global warming and what you're trying to do here. Maybe this summer is just a perfect storm of all these wildfires and high heat, but it may be simply a foretaste of what we have in store if we don't put this problem on ice, so to speak. Not only will more of my tennis matches get canceled, but more and more people, what are my patients, will be impacted. I'm going to have to tell more and more of my patients, look, you're overweight, you've got high blood pressure, you've got borderline diabetes, your arteries are filling up with plaque. You really should go out there and walk every night about 2 miles, but don't you dare for the next 2 weeks because we've got AQIs that are just out of sight. And so more and more it's going to impact the problem we already have with obesity and diabetes and vascular disease. And so that makes this problem much more critical. Just the fresh air that we try to tell people to get is just might kill them. Your board has come up with this global warming scenarios. The medium warming scenario, extreme heat days might increase from 20 a year to 70 per year by the end of the century. Wildfires might increase by 55% by the end of the century, similar to what we've been seeing lately. So this would not only affect the quality of life in our valley in terms of less days to play tennis, less days to go out there and take a walk to lose some of that white, but the quantity of life. The lives will be shortened due to this, due to early deaths from heart disease and lung disease. The Climate Change Group of the California Department of Public Health constructed a social vulnerability index, which you're probably familiar with. The Mariposa, Tulare, and Kern found to be populations of high social vulnerability. We certainly need to identify these populations to make sure that we can prevent heat-related illnesses and also make sure that there's not too many offsets are appearing in those highly impacted areas. Also, revenues that come out of this program should not only go to lowering, reducing levels of greenhouse gases, but also to reducing those pollutants which particularly affect human health. The particulate matter is the PM2.5s and the ozone layer, ozone levels. Thank you so much for your time and your efforts.
Thank you. Number 33. 34. 34.
Good afternoon. My name is Rosenda Mataka, and I live in Grayson, which is in Stanislaus County. And referring to the reference that was made about people that travel from Stanislaus County over the Altamont on a daily basis, that is totally true. But of our population, if half are commuters, the other are farm workers. So we have people in cars or out of cars almost all day, maybe 12 hours of the day. So our community's interest is basically the health impacts that decisions that are made within this scoping project are going to have on the communities. I was interested in the term that said co-benefits. What good could come out of this? And one of those was, of course, the health benefits and how the health benefits are actually going to be looked into. There's something that's said here about community, local community, and I guess it should be more of a broader kind of sweep on what's happening to people's health, not just one little area, but let's look at a bigger sweep, and I'm not saying regional or state. I'm not exactly sure what that would look like, but I think we need to get a true sense on what's going to happen in my rural community as opposed to what's going to happen in downtown Fresno, and I'd really like to see that modeled very clearly. One of the other things was actually the jobs that could be redistributed or a transition of jobs that will take place with any kind of solutions to global warming. And what I would like to see is that whatever that transition or redistribution is, it does not is not on the backs of communities such as mine. That you traditionally, what happens if you want to put something, cite something poisonous, you cite it in a position, in a community with less political power, and whatever that transition is, I would not like to see that occur where I live. Another thing is, it was a mention about monies, like what if people were fined or fined or however term you want to use, what would that money best be used for? Well, in communities that I come where housing, good housing, with low cost of energy and transportation and are like, these are things that we need. So if it was a way to use any money that there was available to communities such as mine where that would better the livelihood and actually not cause people to travel and get a sick. So that's one thing with the housing, if that money could be used for that kind of housing. For solar panels, anything to reduce the use of electricity. Another thing is transportation. I read on there it says Proposition 1B funds. Well, Stanislaus County is actually one of the areas where one of these is being proposed. It's a rural community. Rail transport is being proposed. It's one of those intermodals. And there's a big outcry in the community. And they're saying, yes, you want to help regional, but what about us that live here and going to have to survive with this increase of gas and transportation effects every day? So that is also a big concern when you are addressing local, supposedly that are going to help out the reduction of global gases. And the land use, one thing about agriculture I found really interesting was the global warming that we're having due to agriculture is a lot is transportation. And how do we start thinking in terms of being more sustainable and growing food that we need more locally instead of having to transport it all around the world? And so giving us a more local view as to how agriculture works and a different way to help with the global warming issues. And so more green housing, better jobs. And the thing about not having good wages for people, it just No, that's a no-no. You have to really provide good wages for people that live here in the Valley and in the state, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Number 35, 36, and I've got one more guy over here. 37,
37. Good afternoon. My name is Carlos Hoister. I work for Fresno Metro Ministry. Fresno Metro Ministry is a faith-based organization that addresses issues of social justice, and we work on the air quality aspects of it, too. I have a question rather than a lot of comments. What is your rationale for the timeline of this project?
Well, I guess the short answer is there was legislation passed that directs that certain things happen at certain times, and we're implementing that legislation. I think the longer answer is when that legislation was being developed, there was a lot of discussion about the urgency of the issue versus how fast can something this complicated and this important be put together. And so there was a lot of discussion back and forth, which ended up in a series of deadlines that are in the bill, and we're now going forward according to those deadlines that we were handed by the state legislature.
If I may, I have also a second question. Are we already stabilizing or reduction, or are we still in exponential growth of emissions of climate change?
It's not exponential, but emissions are certainly growing. Yeah. To get back to the goal of this legislation, and this is for California to achieve this legislation, they would need to stabilize and then drop. Actually, if you just look at the past year, they may be stable because of energy prices. I'm not sure of, yeah, like what's going on with the on a year-to-year basis. But overall, our projection is that if we do nothing, emissions will be higher in 2020 than they are today.
Oh, yeah. Well, the reason that I'm asking that, because this document gives me a feeling that doesn't have the sense of urgency of the matter. Doesn't have a sense of what is in stake, especially for California. I urge you to consider what is under evaluation. I don't know if you guys have it under the sleeve, the carbon fees and the real effective market based of the carbon emission problems to consider more seriously and soon. In other words, tax the sources of pollution. And the citizens, we're citizens, I reassure you, will be more creative in polluting. Thank you.
Thank you. 38. 39? Oh, I'm sorry, 38? Got to be fast.
Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne Noble, and I'm representing the Western States Petroleum Association. WSPA provided you detailed comments at your South Coast workshop, so what I'm going to mention today is going to be additional to that. Your draft scoping plan includes a significant discussion on fees and the use of revenues from those fees. But I think it's important to point out AB 32 does not provide CARB with the authority to impose carbon fees beyond those necessary to cover the administrative costs of the program. Therefore, use of carbon fees, as discussed in your draft scoping plan, requires additional legislative authority for CARB to assess and for CARB to allocate, distribute funds generated by such fees. It's important for you all to be noting that. Also mentioned earlier, unfortunately, the plan does not include a discussion on carbon capture and storage. Of course, WSPA believes that carbon capture and storage is critical to the success of this program. We urge CARB to include in the final scoping plan a regulatory framework for a workable carbon capture and storage program, as required in AB 32. Further, we urge that the scoping plan promote research, development, and demonstrate carbon capture and storage in California. The draft scoping plan envisions the low carbon fuel standard as a major contributor to achieve AB 32 emission reduction goal. CARB is also evaluating inclusion of transportation fuels in the cap and trade scheme for 2020. The low carbon fuel standard alone will be a major undertaking, requiring the use of breakthrough innovations that have not yet been developed. We urge CARB to carefully assess the pros and cons of including transportation fuels under the cap and trade program. The final scoping plan must not inhibit industry's ability to provide adequate, reliable, and affordable supplies of energy. There is nothing in the draft scoping plan regarding tracking mechanisms or early indicators that will identify and disclose the effort of the effect of the plan on energy supplies and its impact on the economy. We urge that the final scoping plan incorporate such tracking measures or early indicators that will allow for CARB to identify needed course corrections on any ongoing basis. The five-year review is a minimum required in AB 32. Ultimately, California consumers will be the judge of the program's success. California will still need adequate, reliable, affordable energy supplies, including electricity, heat, and transportation fuels. CARB needs to ensure that goal can be achieved as we move forward to a low carbon world. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Number 39.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Sharp. I'm with the Coalition for Clean Air. We are a statewide nonprofit dedicated to restoring clean air for the entire state of California. I work here in the San Joaquin Valley, though, in my office here in Fresno. I'll keep my comments short. I know that you'll be hearing from other colleagues of ours around the state. We have created a concept paper about if cap and trade were to happen, how we best believe it would be best to further that. But making sure that it really protects environmental justice communities and local communities from localized impacts. So I won't go too much into that, but you will be receiving our written comments on that. I also wanted to comment on land use and the question that one of you had about all the good work that's being done here. And I think that we definitely have heard great comments, and so this room is not representative of our entire region, unfortunately, because I feel so at home here. And so there's a lot of people who are very supportive here, but there's also a lot of people who still have to learn and figure out how that we fit into this process. I think we still have, local government officials who still don't maybe believe that climate change is happening, although that has changed a lot even in the last 2 to 3 years. So I would encourage you to outreach them a lot more. It's great to have, a supervisor from Tulare County, but we don't have any other supervisors here. As far as like the SEGA Southeast Growth Area plan, that's very unique, and it's very urban centered because we have a lot of people here who have been around the world and really want to make things different, but we still do have to battle the old way of doing things. And so, just want to keep that in mind that we do need to have some requirements, not just suggestions for our land use agencies. And I think I will close with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And don't read into my earlier comment that I thought that, this was the best of all possible worlds and we could just declare victory. It was more curiosity, I guess, over the breadth of what I had been hearing and what's a very controversial area. Number 40.
Hi, thank you. And thank you for putting this event on today. My name is Greg Martin. I'm a planner with the Planning Department for the City of Selma. Sorry, can you hear now?
That's
better?
Great, yeah.
Okay, my name is Greg Martin. I'm a planner with the City of Selma here in Fresno County, about 20 minutes south of here. And Yes, I did raise my hand earlier when you were asking, you know, does everyone feel this way, or does everyone agree so much with the more land use controls, et cetera? And, you know, not everyone. And I agree with the previous speaker's comment that not everyone agrees with or would be so supportive of everything in this plan. And I would say that in order to change behavior of cities and cities, smaller cities, counties, who don't necessarily have the resources to undertake some of these measures. For example, my city is less than 25,000 people. So anything we do, we're running on a very tight financial margin. And as a matter of fact, with the downturn in sales taxes recently, we've had layoffs at the city and we've had budget shortfalls. And so we run on pretty thin margins. And we basically, the city is pro-growth. And being a small city that from which a lot of people commute from Selma to Fresno, the housing types that are in demand in Selma will not be the same housing types that are in demand in a city like Fresno. And so the decision makers in my city are very wary of any land use controls that would be imposed by the state. So I would say that I definitely have to review the plan, but I would be looking for basically ammunition for me as a planner to go to the city council and say, see, there really is something in it for us, for this our specific city. There's a way we can do this without incurring a bunch of new costs. There's a way we can do this without driving away developers, because, you know, like it or not, a lot of the financial health of small cities is dependent on new development and being pro-growth. So I think land use measures should be based on incentives. They should not be a one-size-fit-all. Every city needs to have this proportion of different land uses. And of course, the smaller the cities are, the more financially challenged the cities are, the more wary they're going to be of mandates, and, you know, they normally call unfunded mandates. So I'll just be looking through this plan to look for something that our city can really use to its advantage, too, because of course we want to be on board with this and reduce emissions, reduce greenhouse gases, reduce pollutants, because of course we have very bad air quality. But we want to be able to do that in a way that's going to make financial sense for us, since we run on such thin financial margins to begin with. And so I'll just be looking for some ammunition to convince the decision makers in my community that it's really not only in the general interest, but in also something that we can actually do.
Well, we'll see what we can do for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Number 41.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here, and thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. My name is Alex Sheriffs. I'm a family physician in Fowler, which is about halfway from here to Selma. We're a little bit smaller than Selma, about 5,000 people. Again, family physicians take care of people of all ages. I've also served as the immediate past chair of the Fresno Madera Medical Society's Public Health Committee. The Fresno Madera Medical Society represents about 1,000 doctors. The committee has focused for the past several years on air quality, as the adverse health effects of air quality become more and more obvious, have been affirmed in study after study, and published in leading medical journals, New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association. And these studies confirm the impression of practicing physicians like myself that indeed we're seeing more asthma in kids. We're seeing the increasing phenomenon of asthma in adults who never smoked, which I never saw when I was a resident, and the deadly role of those small particles, the PM2.5s, in heart disease. The issue is indeed urgent. In the past 2 years, we've increased our ability to quantify that health burden of bad air quality, something on the order of 200 excess deaths every year in the valley here, over 400,000 school absence days every year, order of magnitude $1.5 billion in health costs added to the valley, added to our costs when we're looking at both Medicare and Medi-Cal cutbacks in an era already underfunded system, and certainly an underserved area. Air quality also threatens our ability to attract and retain doctors and other healthcare professionals here in the Valley. I think every physician knows physicians who, in fact, have left the Valley because of their children's asthma or other health concerns related to air quality. Our youngest daughter is currently in nursing school in San Diego. She observed on her last visit here she hadn't needed her inhaler since she moved to San Diego, since she left the Valley. I do not expect her to return to the Valley with her much-needed professional skills, and that makes me very sad. Now, this is all by way of background to urge the legislative action, your consideration of approaching this on multiple fronts. We need to lessen air pollution, greenhouse gas emissions. I did not drive to this meeting by choice. I drove here for lack of choices. Land use planning clearly impacts transportation choices and options. And that painful increase in gas prices that we've all experienced, none of that money goes to the health effects of our use of gasoline, diesel fuel. Our San Joaquin Air Pollution Control Board has been much criticized for its postponement of deadlines. But on the issue of indirect sources, I think the board was absolutely correct and apparently ahead of its time. We cannot continue to do business as usual. Yes, we have to do business, but we can't do it as usual. To do it as usual is to add to our Valley's health burdens. Land use, as we have done it in the past, is a prescription for failing health. Prosperity at the cost of coming generations' health is not prosperity. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have a number higher than 41? Because I think he may have been the last guy. Okay. 42? 43? Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I was wrong. 42.
Good afternoon. My name is Kim Thompson. I'm the Air Quality Director of the Fresno Madera Medical Society, and I have three simple comments based on what we've heard here this morning. First, I want to reiterate the gratitude that have been already been expressed by a number of people here for having a workshop in Fresno. And thank you also for such an excellent job in speaking and in the public process here this morning. You've made such a great impression with us. Thank you very much. In terms of the comments that I have related to the scoping plan, I just want to say three things. The first is that I myself have been very impressed with the level of public health and medical input this morning. And just to raise the issue that this scoping plan for AB 32 presents a tremendous opportunity for greater involvement of public health and medical sectors in the specificity of the plan itself and also of implementation. Secondly, I'd also like to amplify a comment that Dr. Tellis made earlier, which is about the potential of physicians as educators on these critical issues. My job partly is to help educate physicians, to help educate patients in the Fresno Madera areas and also throughout the San Joaquin Valley, as we, sister medical societies up and down the valley, join with our sister societies across the state to feed into the California Medical Association. So please let us work with you in physician and patient education to improve the quality of life in our state and especially in our valley. Thirdly, in representing the Fresno Madera Medical Society, I also serve on the Fresno County Blueprint process, and I noticed the tremendous amount of comments this morning in terms of land use issues and changing our plans. I just, as a member of that Fresno County Regional Fresno County Blueprint process, I'd like to suggest that if there's a way in which CARB can create or distribute guidelines specifically for regional and county blueprint processes, that may be helpful, especially as those of us, like myself, would like to continue to advocate for these kinds of smart growth principles that will help us along. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jeff, do you have a comment? Are we contemplating guidelines for the blueprint along the lines of what she's talking, or how does that fit into what's on the table so far?
Yes, we've heard a lot of comments about, because the plan basically says it's to reach regional targets, a vision to reach those targets needs to happen. The blueprint process is the process that seems to bring the most people together and has been successful in a lot of regions, and it's happening. So we've heard that there needs to be some guidelines on what ARB expects of that during that blueprint process to be able to best reach those visions. So thank you. Yes.
Thank you. 43.
Good afternoon. My name is Rosemary Amaral, and I am a health educator with the Fresno County Department of Public Health. And I'm here today to just create a little bit of awareness. You've been hearing, as you've heard today, a lot about land use, and there's a lot of folks here today that are definitely tying land use into climate change. And I wanted to just share with you a little bit about our local efforts that we're doing here within Fresno County as well as the region. There has been a regional effort through funding from private foundations to create awareness about the built environments and its impacts to public health. Specifically, local governments are working with community partners to create access to healthy foods and physical activity. This is being done with support from local foundations such as the California Endowment's Central California Regional Obesity Prevention Programs. Programs such as these are educating and creating awareness at all levels of the spectrum, from policymakers to community residents. Foundations are supporting local governments and community partners because they recognize that the public health impacts, as well as the tie to climate change. There's movement up and down the state with local governments and community partners tying in climate change to the built environment. So you'll be hearing from more of us, I'm sure. My recommendation here today is to make sure you continue to include a thorough evaluation of the public health impacts within the scoping plan. Thank you.
Thank you. 44.
Guess that's me, and that happens to be my favorite number.
Good.
I'm just kidding, it's not. My name is Ray Leon. I'm with the Latino Environmental Advancement and Policy Institute, LEAP Institute, and I am born in Fresno, raised in the farm worker community on the west side of this county called Huron. Don't ask me why they named it that way. But here to share a little bit, I guess, on just the reality of the valley. And actually, I wanted to begin by saying, bienvenidos a la ciudad de Fresno. Bienvenidos al valle de San Joaquin. And that is a language that is spoken by and large. It's the second most spoken language in this region. Over 40% of the population in the San Joaquin Valley is Latino. And as we know, in this valley, when we talk about the San Joaquin Valley, we're talking also to a good extent about agriculture. When we talk about agriculture, we are also talking to a good extent about farm workers. And of course, when we speak of farm workers, we talk by and large about Latinos. That's who the majority of the farm workers are. I would say over 80%. But unfortunately, when we talk about farm workers, we talk a lot about some of the problems and issues we continuously deal with in respect to farm workers, not only in terms of low wages, not only in terms of exploitation, not only in terms of lack of health care, but also in terms of what just recently in the past couple of weeks, what we've witnessed is that in the area of Tracy, a young lady, she was pregnant, she collapsed due to the heat. And while she was working in the field. Again, it took place in the county of Kern. All of this is attributable to global warming. And the fact that this is such a huge problem that we really need to rev it up to such an extent where all of us, to some extent, are going to have to sacrifice something. Industry definitely is going to have to sacrifice something because humans are dying today. It's not a speculation. It's an actuality. And it's a reality that a lot of the communities, especially those that do not have the resources to deal with these problems, are facing. It's a reality. You may not feel it in here with this nice AC, and I appreciated it also, but we need to come to grips in terms of what's really happening out there. And I'm glad to see the supervisor from Tulare County. Tulare County, a couple of years ago, had the highest ag revenue. Unfortunately, then, and it continues to be, the poorest county in the state of California. Those issues have to do with the disproportionate impact as well, especially when not only you're working in these tough conditions where the heat is killing you, but you go home, say you live in the community of Parlier, you're a farm worker. Parlier is a highly Latino community, farm working community, a low income community, a rural community. Well, there is a power plant of 565 megawatts proposed for that community. And that is why I am against offsets, because offsets are taking credits out of any other part of this region, but concentrating all that pollution in a community that is already disproportionately impacted, low income, community of color. It's a classic environmental justice scenario, and it is not fair for the residents of this valley. It is not fair. It is a pollution that is fossil fuel based, right? And when we talk about charging a fee to the petroleum industry, some people really get frustrated and angry, but the reality is that it needs to be charged. Something needs to happen to really put in some R&D into the alternatives that need to take place. Research and development for clean, green technology that will not only provide jobs for our community residents, some of which have been exploited in the agricultural industry, but also give them a fair wage so that they could have health insurance, so that they don't find out their child has asthma the day they get the asthma attack, but more so have coverage so that they could prevent that asthma attack. Asthma attack, by the way, doctors will tell you, it could cause death. And so they return home to where a power plant is being established. And that's something we got to deal with. I do not agree with the trading of pollution credits. That is not right. Not only do I not agree with it, I believe it's a human rights breach. Because at the end of the day, those pollution sources or that pollution will end up in Huron, perhaps in Navanel, Parlier, Arvin, already recognized as one of the nation's most contaminated community in respect to ozone, 8-hour ozone. And with not paying attention to those type of scenarios, we continue to perpetuate a system that continues to create these environmental justice communities or injustice scenarios. We need to support 33% RPS renewable portfolio standard, 33% by 2020. We need to support low carbon fuel standards to 10% by 2020, if not sooner. We need to work as fast as we can to assist those that are creating these efforts, these endeavors, these projects for green jobs. Because in the San Joaquin Valley, we have plenty of sun. Clean Tech is a leader out here in establishing that solar farm. And we have a lot of land that has been put out of production, creating even more poverty than what we've had. Communities on the west side may not have lettuce season next year, and that is a huge economic blow. But why not have some of the manufacturing of that clean technology in those areas, in the clusters of poverty, where we develop jobs, we provide those communities with economic development opportunities? There's one solution taking care of various problems. And
could you wrap just continue. Up, please?
In conclusion, sir.
Look at that. We practiced this.
Of course, this is like the 50th time, though. I'm just kidding. So just in terms of the land use issue, there's a huge disconnect regarding the air district and land use. A number of years back, Adams Community, it's Jane Adams Elementary School, that community by McKinley in 99, it's surrounded by about 8 different sources of diesel pollution, I can't even remember the word right now, distribution centers, the railroad track, of course, in 99, and a lot of diesel pollution in that school. That school is recognized as having the third highest asthma rates in the Fresno Unified. I think it's higher. You know, you got to, you know, having health insurance or have your child had asthma attack to know that they have that illness. But anyways, a couple years back, the city gave a rockery, which brought in 12 more diesel trucks, permit, a CUP. To establish business. Nobody in the community knew about what was happening. It just took place. So a year later, the school gets a notice from the Air District regarding that same issue. But So they're going to hear to give them a permit or to deny it or whatever. They ended up giving them the permit, but I think it was either they give them the permit and not look bad or not give it to them and look weak, because once you got that CUP going, what else are they going to do? And I've had conversations with them in the past. So there's a huge disconnect in terms of the land use issues and the air quality issues, the air district in the San Joaquin Valley, and the fact that the air district only has a socioeconomic analysis for industry when they establish or develop regulations is that's fine that they have that, but let's have a community health socioeconomic impact analysis as well, in terms of how will the community be impacted by this new source of pollution that is coming in. Let's have that also. Let's not just do the profit-oriented type of business. Let's do the public health-oriented type of business. Let's bring about balance, fairness, and then we could have some justice to continue forward together. So.
Thank you. Number, is there a 45? Anyone with a number higher? Then, this last person who had asked to conclude, I believe you were number 15.
My point had already been made by others, and I had to write up some new ones. Its testimony has been very good. I'm Arthur Unger. I'm from Bakersfield. I'm chair of the Kern Kaua chapter of the Sierra Club. I'll speak only for myself, and the Sierra Club California will submit written comments. I'm happy to have you in the valley, and I hope you will come down to all the various towns, such as the ones you've heard from. You can snoop around. Maybe you'll find incandescent bulbs like the ones that are soon to be removed from this room. And you can listen to people when they say, you're going to have those little lots next to my half-acre lot? That's terrible. But that's where the sprawl comes from. You, on the other hand, are holding this meeting next to the Amtrak station, which makes it very easy for me to get home on the 210. When we learn to travel without single or limited occupancy vehicles, that'll get more important. And we'll have our businesses and our government offices in Central City. The San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District, for example, several years ago, left their office a few blocks from here and went out to the land of the car. The inner city neighborhoods and their transit must be made so safe that that never happens, and that no one seeks security in a private vehicle. That's something we can do for the less affluent. Another thing we can do for them is help make their houses more efficient. But a thing we shouldn't, in my opinion, do, and just my opinion, is subsidize their fuel bills. Instead, we should help them paint their homes white, maybe if we have the money, some solar photovoltaics on the roof, efficient appliances. People are making less CO2 if they live in a multiple family dwelling, and we could get more of those if we made them nicer and if we had vest pocket parks with playgrounds and basketball hoops. The poor also need buses. You've heard about the interregional buses that we need from a few speakers, and we subsidize our buses now so that the fare box is, I think, only a fourth or a fifth of the cost of riding the bus. Those people who ride the bus aren't making the impact that suburbanites like me make in the Prius, even. We need to build less roads like the Kern River Parkway, the road in Bakersfield that leads to the sprawl, and we need to spend money instead on buses. I hope you will, another topic, I hope you will study the emissions of CO2 from and other greenhouse gases from compost versus nitrogen fertilizer, and also investigate more the fruit trees. How long do they live? where do they go in order to be disposed of and to be turned into energy, and can these trees yield energy without making criteria pollutants? I don't think those trees will do as well as the long-lived pines way up in the Sierra, which we have to just keep the houses away from so that they won't burn so often, and similarly in the chaparral. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Did I see a hand at the back? Are you interested? Please come forward.
I didn't know I needed a number. My name is Sandra Brock, speaking now as a private citizen. I live in a semi-rural area that was subdivided 30 years ago, and it's not going to go away. People will continue to move into these foothill communities outside of urban centers. I would like to see the Air Resources Board work more closely with the Public Utilities Commission on rate structuring. In my area, the distribution system was never constructed to handle the load it has. With global warming, that load will only increase as more people feel the need for refrigerant air conditioning versus so-called swamp coolers or evaporative cooling. Higher temperatures mean that there's more resistance in the wires themselves that try to carry the load, and your power drop from generation source to the people who need the power will be greater. So you'll waste more resources trying to generate more electricity to push it, and the cost will go up, and it's kind of a spiral, as most global warming problems are. Right now, the rate structure is such that people who put in solar panels on their roof would take forever to recover their costs. The panels and some of the components would have to be replaced before you were done paying for it. And I would ask that the PUC look at, the Air Resources Board ask the PUC to look at incentives and rate structures that allow these people to be reimbursed beyond the cost of their own personal power bill at their house. I'm not expecting people will get rich from putting solar panels on their roof, but the fact that you will only recover the cost of your own bill means that people who could maybe front the cost and get the loan for these may be less inclined to do so, whereas with a better reimbursement, the thing will pay for itself in a normal, reasonable amount of time. People who could front the loans could put the panels in, and the neighborhood and the distribution system overall would receive the benefit. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've run through the numbers. Anyone else that wishes to speak here? Okay, well then just a few things in conclusion. I'd like to thank everyone. I'd like to thank those on the webcast that are following our process. There were a number of people here that said they appreciated us coming down to Fresno to listen. Well, it was very interesting, at least for me, but I think on behalf of our whole group, it was a very interesting session for us as well. It was interesting to see the very large public health and medical side of the testimony. That's more than we've seen in some of the other jurisdictions. And just in general, there were a number of what I found to be very thoughtful and useful comments. You know, we do this a lot, but it never ceases to amaze me that, you know, we come out to a new group and you hear some things that you hadn't heard before. And that, you know, that truly happened today. So it was a very useful session for us. Please stay tuned. As we've said, we're maybe partway through our scoping plan process, and then once we put out that plan, there's two more years to turn the recommendations in the plan into regulations, and so this is something we're going to be at for a while, and would urge your sustained participation and interest to help make this as good a process as it can be. And with that, thank you very much, and we'll call this to a close.